So we're going to finish up the A201 today. We stopped off at the end of Article 4. I had hoped I'd get through Article 5 last week, but I didn't, and we're obviously running late, so I'm going to be compressing some stuff, which is fine, because it's less for you guys to have to worry about in the exam. But if you want to hear the full exam, or the full stuff that I'm skipping on this, on the same website, you can go and listen to last year's. We started at Article 5 and went forward, but that's only at your leisure or years from now when you want to study the ARE. So I don't want to press you guys too much longer, but I'll get through what I can get through, and we'll make sure we cover the stuff that's important. So if you remember, Article 3 was about the contractor's obligations, and Article 4 was about the architect's obligations. Article 5 is about the subcontractor's obligations. And so in this case, the subcontractors don't sign the agreement, so you have to tell the contractor what the subcontractors are going to be responsible for. And if you remember, I talked a little bit about the umbrella and the triangle. At the top is the owner, and one side is the architect, the other side is the contractor. And then there's all these contracts beneath each side, the subconsultants for the architect and the subcontractors for the contractor. So it's under the subcontractor's umbrella, and you want to create this language in the main or the prime agreement, which is what this contract is, that instructs the contractor, these are the things your subcontractors must follow. They're sometimes called flow-down provisions. Now, there's going to be other stuff in Article 3 that the contractor should flow down as well, but this is the stuff as far as the responsibilities and how the relationship works between the subcontractor, contractor, and owner. So, under 511, it just describes this as the definition of who the subcontractor is. Now, what's different about the AIA document, and this is one thing if you're putting together, and that's the only kind of relevant for these two things on the definitional side. Let me get the door here. But in the AIA contract, the subcontractor is the first level down. And it says it's just the person who has a direct contract with the contractor. So it's only one level down. The subcontractors have sub-subs and suppliers and vendors and everything else. And so in the AIA form documents, there's a definition for a sub-subcontractor, and that's everybody one step further down, and that has to do with contractual relations and stuff. Other contracts that you will see lump these together. So it's important in understanding the relationship that if you see the term subcontractor, capital S, we know it's a defined term, make sure that it's either the prime first level subcontract or does it include everybody under that umbrella. And the reason why this comes into play is sometimes you want to make sure those flow down provisions. Owner says, contractor, you must carry this type of insurance. You want everybody underneath them to carry the same type of insurance. And so if it says subcontractor and it doesn't split between the levels, then all the trades down below have to do it. But if here, if we see the word subcontractor with a capital S, it's just the first tier. So that's it's a definitional thing, and I just pointed out as something you want to look at in a contract of how they define and who is it. Because if I'm a guy just supplying lumber to the project under the AIA, I'm a sub-sub. But in another one, I could be a subcontractor. The award of the subcontracts and other contracts. So this talks about the contractor shall notify the owner and the architect who will be doing the principal portions of the work. And we use the principal because, remember, it's the first tier. And who are the folks to furnish the materials and equipment? Those are normally going to be the sub-subs. And then the architect shall notify the contractor owner if they have any reasonable objection and if they need additional time to review. So what will happen on a project is the architect, you as the architect, will be most likely have been hired because you work in a certain type of discipline. I do homes. I do hospitals. I do malls. I do industrial buildings. And over the course of your career, you're going to work with many contractors over and over and over. And you're going to have certain subcontractors that will be on a project site, and you'll get to know whether their skills are good. And so what the owner may be looking to you, because the owner relies on you, they don't know all the stuff that's going on in the industry, is to say, hey, is Plumber Bob a good plumber? I've got a list from the general contractor that they're going to bring in Plumber Bob to do the work. If you've worked with Plumber Bob and you don't think that they're a good one, then you could make a reasonable objection under this and you would be informing the owner. So the architect is the kind of the information knowledge base. And there are going to be many times on a project that you as the architect won't know top or bottom. And so you don't have any opinion one way or the other. But the owners are frequently going to rely on you to say, hey, is this a good team? Is this the A team? And so that's what this is for. Now, the architect may notify the contractor whether the owner or the architect. So in this case, the architect can say there's an objection on behalf of the owner, or they can make an objection. That doesn't mean that the contractor has to kick Plumber Bob off the project. It's a notification that we have a re-objection with that, and then that starts a dialogue. So this doesn't give the authority for the architect to reject Plumber Bob. It just says it gives the authority to say we have an objection. I've had many projects where we have subcontractors that get swapped out. I've had many projects where there was maybe an objection, and we keep the subcontractor for a variety of reasons. Another thing that may come up is if you're working in office buildings. The office building themselves have their list of preferred subcontractors. And so the contractor may come in with Plumber Bob, and you have to look at the building's list of preferred electricians or plumbers. And so for that, Plumber Bob, if he's on the approved list, can work on it. If not, the contractor and the owner and the architect have to work with the building using this provision to see who's the proper entity that's going to do the plumbing. Okay? Yeah.
So if an architect doesn't approve of a contract or a subcontractor,
yes.
And then that part of the project goes wrong, would there be an argument about a breach or anything?
So you're. Let me see if I understand your question right.
Okay.
The contractor. Pardon me?
Like the architect is saying, I told you that this is not good, and
right. So if I understand your question, contractor says, I'm going to use Plumber Bob. Architect raises their hand and says, I don't think Plumber Bob's a good plumber. I recommend not using them. And you inform the owner, and the owner and the contractor talk it out, and Plumber Bob stays. Then down the road, it turns out the plumbing is done poorly. Your question is, who's responsible for the screw-ups? Number one, Plumber Bob is always going to be responsible for their work no matter what. Number two, as far as the owner's concerned, because the owner doesn't have a contract with Plumber Bob, the owner will look to the general contractor and says, you promised me that Plumber Bob could do the job. My architect gave me the heads up, and you told me that they could do good work. So the primary is going to be the contractor and the subcontractor. Those are the people that ultimately are responsible for. If the architect has said, I object to them, and nobody listens to the architect will be able to say, I told you so, and will have no liability. But the architect probably, if I was the architect, I'd just stay out of it. And then what's going to happen is the contractor is going to say to the owner, we talked about this, I showed you this and this, and you approved. And so there may be, if it goes to a jury or judge, there may be an apportionment where like 80% goes on the contractor and 20% goes on the owner because the owner walked in with open eyes. And so it depends on that communication. The other scenario could be this. If the architect says, these people are fine, and the architect knew that Plumber Bob did bad work, if it comes out later that the owner can show that the architect withheld information that was important, the owner could make a claim against the architect and say, you withheld that information, but it's still going to be probably 75 to 80% on the contractor side, because no matter what happens, they still have to build it. And the architect may take a little bit of a hit because they just kept their mouth shut. So there could be some liability there, but at the end of the day, the party that's doing the work, and that's the plumber, and the party that's responsible for overseeing the work, that's the general contractor, they carry most of the freight. So this is that's a really good question, because sometimes that comes up in cases, and sometimes I've had that discussion with an owner. Why should we use this if there's an objection to it? And sometimes it's price, sometimes it's expediency. Sometimes it's like, there's only one plumber available in the area, and the next one won't be available for 6 months. We could delay the project. So you make these decisions, but then you want to make sure that the contractor stays over. So there's all these things that happen during the life of the project that if you as the architect are aware, you want to kind of keep on it and say, hey, owner, make sure your contractor's keeping plumber Bob in line. So it's a discussion point. It's one that creates communication, which is good. That's a really good question. Okay, 522. The contractor shall not contract with a proposed person or entity to whom the owner or the architect has made reasonable and timely objection. So this is when they say, we object, and this is an instruction for the contractor to say, I can't use you, Plumber Bob, because the owner has objected. Now, it's not a mandate. It doesn't mean it says shall not contract. But if the contractor could come back and convince the owner that Plumber Bob could do the work, then you can go ahead and contract. And so it comes down to this reasonable and timely objection. Is it fair and reasonable? Plumber Bob has done excellent work all the way around. They just had this one crappy job where something went wrong because they had a foreman. He's no longer with the company. There's all these reasons why Plumber Bob may have had a bad experience with the architect. So there's ways you can do it. But if it's a legitimate reason, the owner should take this provision, 522, and say to the contractor, I, as the owner, don't want you to contract with them. And that's kind of like when I was talking about office buildings will have their approved subcontractors. They're going to step in on 522 and say, Plumber Bob's not on my approved list. These are the only subs that I'm going to allow in my building because they know my building and everything else. So that's how they exercise that. But it's even though it's the architect that will be making the objection, the owner should be part of that. So the owner is the one that's ultimately making the decision here. 523, if owner and architect have a reasonable objection, the contractor needs to propose another. Here's Plumber Sue. And if the proposed but rejected subcontractor was reasonably capable of performing the work, the contract sum and the contract time shall be increased or decreased by the difference. So here's a scenario where Plumber Bob does really good work at a bunch of places, but just didn't get along with the architect on the one project that they had. So the architect's objecting, and the owner objects, and now we have to go with Plumber Sue. Plumber Sue's going to be a little bit slower because she's working on another job right now, and Plumber Sue's more expensive. Because the owner has required it to be Plumber Sue, or the building says, I'm only using my preferred plumbers, the owner has to take the responsibility of the additional cost and the additional time. If the contractor can say, I know Plumber Bob had one bad project with the architect, but look at his track record here. And that becomes a question of what's fair and balanced and reasonable. And if you ever get into a dispute long down the road, that's what the judge and jury is going to decide. Was it reasonable? And there are times, and I will tell you this for certain, there are times that owners and architects will refuse a subcontractor just because they don't like the person. And it's not about their work quality. There are going to be other times where an architect will approve a subcontractor because they like the work, the person, even though the subcontractor's work quality is crappy. So what happens in trying to put together that A team is a balance of trust between you and the architect and the contractor. And these provisions are to try to put some guardrails on there, but they are only guardrails. They don't always necessarily are successful in making sure that Plumber Bob or Plumber Sue is the right fit. And you have to kind of see things as they go along the way. It may be that Plumber Sue starts working, and after a while, the owner says, we got to get rid of Plumber Sue. We're going to bring in Plumber Bob, and there's consequences to that as well. So, no increase in the contract sum or contract time shall be allowed for change unless the contractor has acted promptly and reasonably in submitting names. So the contractor, so the owner has to raise their hand pretty quickly and say, don't let Plumber Bob, so long as, because if it gets too late, Plumber Bob's already working on the site. Contractor has their own reciprocal obligation to bring in Plumber Sue and Plumber Sally and Plumber who else as quickly as possible, because both parties need to keep the project moving. We trust the contractor brings in the right people. If there's going to be some shuffling of the subs, let's keep it timely and move forward. 5.3, subcontract relationships. Contractor shall require each subcontractor, to the extent perform work, be bound to the contractor by the terms of the contract documents and assume toward the contractor all obligations and responsibilities, including responsibilities for safety work, etc., etc. This provision says, the contract documents is capital C, capital D, which includes this prime contract. So this contract says, hey, contractor, you must throw down the provisions that are relevant in this agreement to the subcontractor. Everything you, general contractor, are responsible to me for, your sub shall be responsible to you for. What you don't want is owner and contractor have a contract that says contractor's going to do A, B, C, and D, and the contract with the subcontractor says subcontractor's going to do C, D, E, and F. E and F isn't in the A, and A and B isn't in the subcontractor. So you want to make sure that they are parallel, and that's what this provision. It's a throw-down provision that mandates the contractor requires that the subs follow the rules of this prime agreement. Okay? This is really important, because what will happen is a general contractor will have a form that they work with these subs over and over and over and over, and it's a pre-written, pre-negotiated form. And what sometimes happens is they get a job, they send out the forms to all their subs, everybody signs it, and there are specific terms in the owner general contract, the prime agreement, and the general contractor never flows them down. Well, the sub says, I wasn't responsible. I signed a contract that the GC gave me. This is all I'm responsible is for D, E, and F. And if the general contractor didn't tell me about A and B, shame on them. But the owner then can come back to the general contractor and said, A, B, you owe me, and you can't chase it from your sub. So this is important that we have this connection, and it's important that each subcontractor can see the contract document so they all know what's going on, that this slowdown actually happens. Five, four, contingent assignment of subcontracts. So there's some stuff highlighted here, but what I want to do is just kind of short-circuit it is things go wrong on construction projects. And sometimes you don't like the general contractor. They're managing the project very poorly. But you like six or eight of the subcontracts. They're doing really good work. If you kick this general contractor off the job, they're going to take all the toys in the sandbox with them, which is all the subcontractors. That hurts the owner. Because you've got six or eight really good subs that are doing good work and you want them to stay. So before you enter into a contract, you do what's called a contingent assignment. If we have to terminate you, general contractor, that's the contingency. If we have to terminate you, general contractor, we get to pick to keep those subcontractors we want to keep. That's the assignment that happens in the beginning. And so what talks about it here is it's after the termination of the contractor for cause. So we can't kick the contractor off just because we don't like the color of their tie. If we do, that's for convenience, because the general contractor didn't do anything wrong. And if we terminate a contractor for convenience, they can take all their toys in the sandbox, including those six or eight subcontractors. But if we terminate the general contractor for cause, which is what it says here in 541.1, then we can say we already have an assignment and I get to keep those six or eight subcontractors. This is very important. You never want to terminate a general contractor. That's like the nuclear option because it always slows your project down. It's always more expensive. But it happens. Sometimes it just happens. And in those instances, you want to keep the good trade. And that's what Article 5.4 does. We're going to have to get into the details. I modify this. There's a lot of tweaks I can do this. But generally understand, this is something that happens before any work is done. And if I have to kick you off, the general contractor off, because you screwed up, I get to keep some of the toys for my sandbox. Make sense? Okay. 5.2 talks about if the project has been suspended by more than 30 days, subcontractor can get their compensation equitably adjusted. That was similar to if the general contractor. If you stop the project, the subcontractor shouldn't have to sit around if it's not their fault and not get paid. So they get some money for being shut down for a while. That's 5.42. And 5.43, if there's an assignment, this assignment that we're talking about, the owner can take those six or eight subcontractors, but the owner doesn't want to become a general contractor. I mean, we don't do that for a business. I'm going to hire a new general contractor, and I'm going to transfer my six or eight over to them, and they're going to work for the new general contractor. So this is already kind of pre-baked. Before any work happens, the subcontractors know, something really goes wrong with the GC, a general contractor, I may be shuffled off to another general contractor. But at least I'm working, and so that's good for them. Any other questions? Any questions on subcontractors? Okay, Article 6. Now we're going to talk about the owner or the owner's separate contractors. This is the provision in the H01 that talks says what the owner is supposed to be. So here we have definitions. The term separate contractor means another contractor retained by the owner under separate agreements. So you know this example I use, I talk about the hotel. And the hotel, we want to put in a really cool star restaurant. And so the architect designs it and leaves the space open in the first floor that you're going to have this really cool, trendy restaurant. And the owner brings in the restaurant designer, and the owner brings in the restaurant contractor. That restaurant contractor is what's called a separate contractor. And so it's a defined term. So it's any contractor that the owner brings on the job that is not under the control of the general contractor. So it could be a landscaper, could be that restaurant contractor, could be the lighting contractor, could be signage. There's a whole bunch of stuff that the owner may want to control themselves that isn't under the normal purview of the general contractor. For Haribo, all of the equipment that makes all the candy is highly secret. And like, I'm not even allowed to go back and walk the floor of the factory. I'm not allowed to see those machines. So the only people that Haribo uses are separate, special, controlled contractors to install that equipment because it's so secret and it's so much of their process. Those are separate contractors, and we have to make sure that they have a place in the agreement. Because going back to the restaurant one, general contractors working along the building and everything else, if that restaurant contractor is slow or delays the project, the contractor should be compensated for its delay. They're like, hey, it's not my fault your restaurant contractor is so slow, but I have to sit around and wait. Or they screwed up my work. They smashed some of my stuff. They were not clean. I should get compensated for that. So we have to find a place for the owner's work and the owner's special separate contractors here. 613, the owner shall provide for coordination of the activities of the owner's own forces. So the owner now becomes responsible for coordinating. And it is kind of like a general contractor. You have to get the timing and when they're going to come in and where they're going to work. And you have to coordinate their drawings. And you have to make sure that your architect has been coordinating with all that stuff. And then the contractor shall make any revisions to a schedule deemed necessary after joint review of mutual agreement. So what happens there is the special owner's separate contractor to build this kitchen comes in and says, I need these 15 weeks to install my kitchen from X date to Y date. And the contractor's like, oh, we only built into the schedule 12. Now the general contractor can massage its schedule and we'll get paid for those additional 3 weeks because they put in a placeholder that they thought was reasonable, but now the owner's separate contractor is extending it. So there's, again, a communication going on here, and the contractor should not be penalized. It's not really a penalized, but the contractor should not be held from being compensated for delays or problems in a schedule or otherwise when the separate contractor comes in. And if the owner doesn't properly coordinate those times, doesn't get the people to the site on time, doesn't bring in the right materials, doesn't have the connections, whatever, the owner will be responsible for any additional costs that has. So what I do, for me, and this is going to be an exam, is this provision 6.13, I change the owner shall be responsible for coordination, I change this to the contractor. And I say, I tell my clients that are owners, I say, look, you're not a general contractor. The general contractor will charge you additional money to manage everybody. You're still going to be in a separate contract your own with this kitchen builder, the special kitchen builder. But the responsibility of coordinating and timing and who's doing what, let the general contractor do it. That's what they do every day. Pay them a little bit of extra money for it. That's a recommendation that you guys can make to your owners when you get there. It's not going to be part of the exam because we're only test you what's on the document. But I think that owners are not the best people to start coordinating stuff on the project. They should leave that to the general contractor who does it as a professional. It depends on the complexity of the project and what you're asking them to do. So, like, I had a project where the owner wanted to have a direct relationship. It was a very high-end residential home, and they wanted to put in a slate roof. And so the contractor was union, but my client had a relationship with the owners of the slate roof people, and so they were non-union. So the contractor's like, I can't sign that contract because now I get union problems, but because it's a private residence, we can work it out that you can contract with the roofer. And I said, okay, that's fine, but will you coordinate it? And they were like, no problem, because it's just a roofer. It's nothing complex. But when you get into things that are really complex, like there was no way on the Haribo project that we were going to have our general contractor coordinate the installation of that equipment. Even if it wasn't proprietary and secret, they would not want to take the coordination of something as complex as that. So it depends on the type of work that's being done. But that's a really good question. 614, unless otherwise provided, the owner or separate contractor shall have the same obligations and rights the contractor has under this conditions of the contract. This is the owner's requirement to flow down. So, in Article 5, the subcontractors were supposed to take a flow-down clause from the general contractor and be responsible to this. This is the same thing here. Now, it doesn't say contract documents because the separate contractor is not going to be building anything on those drawings or specifications. But it talks about the conditions of the contract, which is really the words here. So, because the separate contractor is going to have its own design for that kitchen area. They're not building the rooms or the elevators or the lobby. So their contract documents, the kitchen builder, will be the kitchen area. But they must still follow all the rules of monopoly, the rules of the game, the rules of construction that is established in this document. It's a consistency thing. And it makes a lot of sense. Like, you don't want to have two parties that have two different rules. That's chaos. Usual responsibility, the contractor on 621 shall afford the owner and separate contractors reasonable opportunity to introduction for storage of materials, equipment, and performance of activities. This is just to make sure, like when you get to a project site, you're going to have an area of called a laydown area, because you got to bring all the materials, the steel, the lumber, you know, wherever it might be. And as the building gets built, maybe sometimes the laydown areas are inside. Well, there has to be designated laydown areas for the separate contractor to do their work. And it's a cooperation between everybody. That's what that provision says. Is, hey, general contractor, make sure you leave enough space for my guy. And owner, make sure that your special contractor is working really nicely with my general contractor, because we don't want to be fighting over where's the space, or, God forbid, it gets damaged. Somebody's materials get damaged, and the parties, the separate contractor and general contractor, are pointing fingers. You damaged my materials. No, you damaged my materials. So if we have this relationship, it helps under 621. 622, the part of the contractor's work depends on proper executions or results upon construction operations by the owner separate contractor. The general contractor, prior to proceeding with portions of work, shall promptly notify the architects of any discrepancies or defects in the construction operations. So what this says is, going back to my kitchen, and the kitchen contractor says, I need these many outlets, and they need to be in these locations because I'm going to put in my range, my stove, my lighting, whatever I'm going to do. I need these many connections for plumbing. I need this drainage. I need these fire suppression. I need all this other stuff. So all that information should have been put into the drawings by the kitchen architect. That information is then supplied to the general contractor, and so when they end their termination, because they're not working in the space where the kitchen is, but they're going to bring a conduit for the electrical, they're going to bring the piping for the plumbing, they're going to do all that stuff that comes into the outside of that envelope of where the kitchen is going to be designed. Kitchen contractor gets on site and says, this is in the wrong place, this is in the wrong place, this is in the wrong place. Well, the general contractor, and you've got to move it, general contractor, because I, as the kitchen contractor, am not going to move someone else's work. If the plumbing's in the wrong spot, I will notice it and point it out, but I'm not touching someone else's plumbing, because then I get in trouble, I own it. So the general contractor has to work with plumber Bob to move it, but if the general contractor followed the original designs, it's not his fault either. So what happened with that coordination? And so this provision talks about that the contractor should advise the architect of discrepancies or defects in the construction operations. It's to say, hey, these aren't in the right spots. And how do we resolve that? And it says at the end, the contractor shall not be responsible. They're not responsible for discrepancies or defects in the constructions or the operations by the separate contractor. Your people are doing their work they're responsible for their screw-ups, they're responsible for the wrong locations. If I have to work around those, I should be paid for that. So that's what this is. This is, again, establishing the rules of when there's a conflict between general contractor and separate contractors. And this happens a lot. I mean, it doesn't always become a huge deal, but sometimes things are off. So it's not an uncommon circumstance, and this is a set of rules of how the parties are supposed to deal with it. 623, the contractor shall reimburse the owner for costs the owner incurs if the separate contractor is caused by its delay, basically because of the contractor's delay. And this owner shall be responsible to the contractor for the cost contractor incurs if it's a separate contractor's delay. So, if my kitchen contractor comes on site and the space isn't ready and they were supposed to start January 1, the kitchen contractor is going to start charging me time to sit around doing nothing. I, as the owner, say to the general contractor, you have to pay those delay damages because you are late. Or the flip side is, kitchen contractor's working in there, so I'm going to be finished in 15 weeks, and now it's 17 weeks in, the general contractor is going to say to the owner, your kitchen contractor delayed me, you have to pay me money for these additional 2 weeks that I'm sitting around. So it's, again, a pretty basic concept, but it's in writing now to say who's responsible for what and how it gets apportioned. Part of the fight will be, of course, I didn't delay, they delayed. No, it's your delay, it's my delay, and that's where you get the experts to come in. But once you figure out who the delays are responsible for, 623 tells who pays for it. We don't have to worry about this, it just talks about cleanup. So that's it for Article 6. Any questions on that? Okay, Article 7 is changes in the work. Now, I've talked about changes throughout all the semester, this concept of a change order. And so you have to have a mechanism or a vehicle by which things are going to be modified in a contract. As you know, and as I've said, none of your drawings are ever going to be 100%. That's number one. Number two, when you dig a hole in the ground, something's happened and something changed. Number three, the owner says, I need another bathroom. There's all these things that happen on projects that require change orders. I don't know of any project that I've ever been involved in, including my $60,000 base backyard renovation where we changed and put a mudroom, that didn't have a change order. They can be tiny, they can be minor, but they always will have one. A good project, you want to put into your budget, and you want to talk to your owner about this, when they come to you with a budget, you're going to say, here's my estimate, and you build into your estimate somewhere between 5 and 10%, I would err on the side of 10%, a good project comes in with change orders that are 5, 10% of the total value of the project. So if it's a $100,000 project, you're going to say in your budget to the, your estimate to the owner, 110. You're going to build in that 10% change order fudge factor so the owner understands that you're not going to break the budget. If you are going actual 100,000 and the project comes in at 110, the owner may say, ah, wait a minute, where did these $10,000 come from? So you want to recognize that. That's a good project, 5 to 10. Many projects come in between 10 and 15, 10 and 20. If you get over 20, that's really expensive. Then you're starting to do something's gone wrong in a project. But that's where your kind of thing is. So how do we handle these changes that happen? They're going to happen on every single project. Article 7 does that. And so it says, changes in the work may be accomplished after the execution of the contract, so after we sign, we're out there working, without invalidating the contract. So we're going to change the contract and it doesn't invalidate it. By change order, that's a defined term, constructive change directive, another defined term, or an order for a minor change in the work. So we're going to go through and define each one of those. A change order, which is a CO, capital C, capital O, you'll see it sometimes as a CO, the initiator, abbreviate that, is based on an agreement between all three parties, owner, contractor, and architect. All three parties have agreed to what is in the change order. And it may or may not be agreed by the, it's constructive change directive, so a change order, all three parties agree to every single thing in it. But there can be times when you have an agreement on some things, but not everything, but you want the project to continue, so that's called a constructive change directive. Now, how do we break that down? What does that really mean? So when I ask for the new bathroom in my two-bedroom, three-bath, or my three-bedroom, two-bath house to get into a three-bathroom house, That's going to be a change order. We know it's going to be a change order because we're changing the drawings, and it's going to be an increased cost. So the scope has changed. So those are the two things, plus it's going to take more time. So you have scope, you have cost, and you have time. General contractor takes the new drawings from the architect to add that third bathroom, prices it out, and comes back to the owner and says, it's going to cost you another $30,000 for this bathroom. And it's going to cost another 3 weeks on the schedule. If the owner says that $30,000 is reasonable, and the architect says it's reasonable, and they think that the time frame of 3 weeks is reasonable, and they all agree to the scope, the time, and the price, and everybody agrees that we signed it in writing, that's a change order. Or the other side scenario could come back, and the contractor says it's $50,000, and it's going to cost 3 weeks, but I have the drawings. And the architect's like, wait a minute. No, this should be somewhere between 20 and 30, 20 and 35. I don't agree, owner. I've done the math on this. It's not a $50,000 project. So what will happen there is that we've agreed on the scope, because we know what the drawings say, and we know it's still going to be 3 weeks. Everybody knows it's 3 weeks to the calendar, so we agree on the time, but we're not in agreement on the price. But if you don't move forward with installing the bathroom, it's going to delay the whole project. So you give a constructive change directive, and you tell the contractor by various methods to track their pricing. If it comes in at $50,000, you pay $50. If it comes in $40, you pay $40. If it comes in $30, you almost do it as a cost of the work. And so that sometimes happens. Or another scenario says is maybe that bathroom has specialty fixtures that we can't get a price for because we're not sure of the fluctuation in the market. So they say, we're going to do this scope. We think it's going to be around $35,000, but it could be up to $50,000. We're not sure. We're waiting on pricing, but we recommend you to go forward. Then you're also going to issue a constructive change directive. It's not a discrepancy. It's not a fight over what the price is. It's just we don't have the final price, but you want to direct the contractor to move forward. So the difference between the two, change order, everybody agrees on scope, price, and time. Constructive change directive, one of those things is not agreed on, or sometimes two of those things are not agreed on, but you need to move forward, so you do that, you tell them to keep working, and eventually you're going to get to that agreement with the parties. And that's where it talks about in 713, the contractor shall proceed promptly with the changes in the work, whether it's a change order or a constructive change directive, they need to continue to move the project along. So, here, a change order is a written instrument, so it has to be in writing. You do not want to, now this is like going back to our first semester, or first part of the semester where you have an oral and everything else. Don't have oral change orders. Any change order you have, even if you had an oral agreement to do the project, don't do oral change orders because that's when you're really going to get killed. Contractors make a lot more money on change orders than they make on the base project. They have a higher overcharge. They know they have you kind of at their mercy because you want this change, whatever. So always get the change order in writing. And as it says, for a change in the work, that's the scope. Adjustment in the sum, that's the price. Or an adjustment in the time. Those are your three elements. And if we all agree on those three elements, it's a change order, capital C, capital O. 7.3 is the constructive change directive. So it's again, a written order. You want both of these in writing. Signed by the owner and the architect. But the contractor probably won't sign it because they're the one asking for more time or more money. But you want to have the owner and the architect sign off at it at least. And if there is an adjustment, if any, in the sum, the time, whatever, whatever's left open, if you can sign off on that, that's great. But we all know one of those three items is going to be left out. 80% of the time is price. So that's what's going to happen in the constructive change directive. So that's what 7.3 says. 7.3.2, a constructive change directive shall be used in the absence of total agreement of a change order. Again, you don't want to have to wait till we all come to the table in 100% agreement because time is money in a project. If you can keep things moving by giving them their directive, use the CCD. Use that to move the project forward. That's 7.3.3, or 7.3.2. 7.3.3, the constructive change directive, it provides an adjustment if it's for a contract sum. You can do it by these methods. And so it tells you, hey, how are we going to figure out this price? We can't come to an agreement. Maybe we can accept a lump sum later on. Maybe we're still negotiating. 50's too high, 30's too low. How about 45? How about 30? Keep working. We're going to do our bartering back and forth, and we're going to nail it at 40 grand at a lump sum. Or unit prices or the cost will determine a matter agreed upon. Why don't you just cost whatever the actual cost is, time and materials, and tell me how that's going on a month-by-month basis. So that's what this gives you. It gives you a roadmap of how to continue with the project on that constructive change directive. 734, if the contractor does not respond promptly or disagrees with the method of adjustment in the contract sum, the architect can determine the methodology. So the contractor's like, well, I don't want to do this lump sum. I don't want you to see behind my books, see behind the curtain. I'm going to do that. And you're like, no, we want to see what you're doing. We want to see your actual charges. And if they're not agreeing in the methodology of tracking the price, this gives the ability of the architect to say how we're going to do the adjustment. And the architect's going to say, you guys got to do it on time and materials. So I want transparency. And they have to follow that under this rule. So, and it goes further. The contractor should keep and present in such form as the architect may prescribe. They're the ones demanding of how we do the accounting here, and itemize accounting together with appropriate supporting data, which is the cost of labor, cost of materials. That's all this other stuff that we have up here, which is basically the time and material, rental costs, cost of premiums, bonds, supervision. So this is basically saying, if we can't come to an agreement of how we're going to price this out, but we want to move forward, the architect is going to say, we're doing a T&M. This is effectively what it says. And you keep track of all your costs, and I know you don't want to see behind the curtains, but you're going to have to for this one. And if you don't, and the architects and I as the owner have agreed, you could be in breach of contract because you're not doing the work. So we don't want to have that position there for the contractor to be able to make the decisions of how to price this out. 735, if the contractor disagrees with the adjustment, the contractor may make a claim, capital C, this is one of the first times we've seen this, with the applicable provisions of Article 15. Now the reason why this is in blue, I haven't had many things in blue here, is because this happens often, is there are discrepancies over change orders. That's where lots of the fights happen, about how much it costs. And so how do we keep the project moving but preserve our rights? General contractor legitimately believes he should be paid $50,000, and the architect says, no, it's not going to be, it's going to be $40,000, and that's all you're going to get paid. Or the contractor has all the documents and shows it's $49,865, but the owner says, you increased your prices improperly, so I'm only going to pay you $40,000. Now we have a dispute over money. And all disputes under this contract find themselves in Article 15. So I highlighted this in blue because what you're going to find is the word claim will come up throughout this document, and the word claim with a capital C automatically sends you to Article 15 to talk about how to resolve that claim. So we'll get that at the very end of the class to make sure you guys understand that. Let me make sure there's anything else. 736 just says, if once you get the CCD, which doesn't have everything there, the contractor has proceeded diligently with the work. A CCD, 737, a constructive change directive signed by the contractor, indicates now the contractor's agreement. So now, we get to the point where we all finally agree. We've been negotiating and we landed $40,000 for that bathroom for a lump sum. Or we negotiated and it turns out that the contractor agrees to do it on time and material. You have this document that's in writing. Remember, it's in writing. It's already been signed by the owner or the architect. As soon as the contractor signs on this methodology or the price that you finally negotiated, the constructive change directive automatically becomes a change order. Because now you have agreement on price, schedule, and scope. So you don't even have to create a new change order. It's this constructive change directive automatically becomes. Now, for bookkeeping purposes and everything else, you should probably change it in the numbers because you're going to have a log of what all the change orders and everything else is. But it is, shall immediately be recorded as the change order. It becomes the change order that has all parties agreeing on all three items. 739, pending final determination of the total cost of a constructive change directive, maybe they're still pricing it out, maybe we're still doing time and materials or otherwise, the contractor may request payment for the work completed under the CCD in an application for payment. And then there's an interim decision, and this interim decision will affect the contract sum and the contract price. So what does this mean? So 739, let's say it's not the bathroom. It's a whole bedroom, bathroom addition. So now it's not a 3-week thing. It's a 6-week or an 8-week addition. And it's $150,000. Well, the contractor's going to get paid every month because that's what your schedule is set up. I get paid on a monthly basis. And we haven't been able to agree whether it's $150,000 or $175,000. So we say to contractor, here's a CCD. Start working on the new bathroom and bedroom combination. And the contractor's like, okay, and at the end of the month, we still haven't figured out the price, but I've spent $78,000. I should get paid for the work I've done on this month, even though we haven't decided whether it's $175,000 or $190,000 for the overall change order. I'm working, and I'm giving you my bills. And so this says, I can get interim payments, and I can submit it with my regular monthly application for payment. That means the contractor doesn't have to be the bank for the owner and hold on and finance this new work while they're negotiating an element. And it's fair. The contractor gets paid. Because if you don't pay the contractor after they've worked on it a month, they're going to stop, and then there's going to be a delay, and there's more fights. So this just gives a mechanism to allow you to get paid for the work you've done while you're still trying to figure out what the final price will be. And this is important. It's just, lots of these provisions are all about keeping the project moving, because again, time is money. Questions on that? 7310, when they agree and a determination is being made concerning the adjustment of the contract sum and contract price, it should be effective immediately and prepare the change order. The change orders may be issued for any part of the constructive change directives. Sometimes, you have the CCD where you have the bedroom and the bathroom, and you can get to an agreement on the price for the bathroom, but the bedroom, because it's going to now have a bay window, and we're still waiting for that special bay window, and then there's going to be special molding and everything else. So you can take that CCD that says, put in a bedroom and bathroom, and while you're negotiating, lock down the price of the bathroom, and you can enter into a change order for that, so that becomes the bathroom change order, and the CCD still sits out there for the rest of the bedroom. So you can start apportioning those things as well, and making sure that the contract continues to be updated. That's what 7310 allows you to do. Again, just a couple more rules of the game of Monopoly, of when you get here, what do you do? And that's what these are there for. 7-4, minor changes in the work. Here's one where the architect has authority. The architect may order minor changes in the work that are consistent with the intent of the contract documents and do not, this is the part that's important, involve an adjustment in the sum or an extension of the time. I painted this room. I thought it was going to be dove white. I want it to be bald eagle gray. As long as the paint's not a different price, it can be a minor change in the work. Hey, that soffit's hanging there. It needed to have been moved a little bit, as long as it hasn't been hung yet and the contractor doesn't have to do rework and it doesn't cost anything. I've moved it, but you haven't framed it out. It could be a minor change. So there are things that the architect can do that are, what makes it minor is that it's no change in price and no change in scope. I'm sorry, price and time. And it's within the general intent of the original contract documents. And it happens on project sites. You may come in and say, well, God, I thought it could be able to be built this way, but it seems like we can't. We've got to tweak it a little bit, but as long as we're all happy with how it is and it's the same price at the same time, let's just move forward. And the architect is allowed by this contract, and it was in the B101, they are allowed to make those minor changes. Now, as a recommendation, as an architect, when you have this color palette for all the children's bedrooms, before you change it from dove white to eagle gray, you probably want to talk to the owner anyway, because when they move in, they probably would have already picked those colors and said, why is my daughter's bedroom gray? It was supposed to be white. So you want to have communication with the owner. But this doesn't require the owner to sign off on these minor changes. And there's going to be plenty of times where the changes you're going to make are these minor things that the owner's never going to see, but it was necessary to keep things moving along. So that'll come up in the course of, the grout color or how, just there's all these little things that will happen. You'll be called in, and the person that's putting up the tiling, they're going to say, how do you want this to go in the corner? What do you want to do? And you can be like, well, you cut it this way, do the pattern. And that just goes down because it's an aesthetic thing. And most of the time, your owner should probably trust you on those items. So, that the contractor believes that the proposed minor change will affect some or time, the contractor has to notify the architect and not proceed with the work. So if the architect comes in and says, hey, I need you to refer how that soffit is and put it in a different place, if the contractor says, well, now that's going to cost more lumber, even though I haven't put the soffit up, it's going to cost me another X linear feet of lumber, that is a change in price. Contractors should not do that work as a minor change, because unless he wants to eat the price. If they're going to eat the additional costs, then they can. But if it is going to affect and they're going to ask for money, they should not do a minor change, do not do the minor work, even though it may seem and feel like minor work. So those are that's the contractor's responsibility. It's not up to the owner to be watching and saying, oh, it's minor or not a minor, nor the architect. The contractor is the one to say, okay, yeah, I'll do that change, but it's going to cost you, and here's how we want to handle it. Any other questions? Any questions on 7 for change orders? Okay. Article 8, time. And we are moving pretty well on time, so that's good. I've said this many times, time is money on a project. So what do we do to handle time? Well, the contract time, capital C, capital T, a defined term, is the time of authorized adjustments allotted in the contract to get to substantial completion of the work. Substantial completion is a defined term, and we're going to talk about that later. It'll be an article. This right here. The date of substantial completion is the date certified by the architects in accord with Section 9.8. 9.8 will give you the definition of actually what substantial completion means. But a project is not substantially complete, contractually and legally substantially complete, until the architect certifies it. They're the ones that walk around. They did the drawings. They're the ones that walk around at the end and says, yes, we are substantial complete, capital S, capital C. I'll tell you what the definition I've told you before. We'll get there in 8.9.8, but I'll tell you what it is right now. Substantial completion is when the building, and it probably won't be the exact language when we get to 9.8, but this is what everybody standard in the industry, is when the building is fit for use for its intended purposes. The hospital can operate like a hospital. The school can operate like a school. You can live in the house. You can go and make the candy at the factory. That's when the building is substantially complete. Will all of the cover plates on the light switches be on? No. Will there be some vinyl flooring that's not baseboard installed? No. Will there be some things that have been nicked and dinged and need to be repatched and repainted? Yes. Those are things that are not necessary for the operation of the building or the project, but it's not at final completion. It's at substantially complete. Substantial completion, I think I've told you before, but I'll say it again, is a big trigger date. It's when all the warranties begin. It's when retainage is released, which we'll talk about when we get in a little bit later on retainage. It's about money, so it's a lot of things happen. It's when the contractor who has responsibility for everything that's going on the site, when it's substantially complete, they turn it over and they say, owner, you're responsible for so many trips and falls now. It's your problem on your insurance, not on my insurance. So this concept of substantial completion is a big deal legally and contractually. And so that's why you as the architect, when you're the one that's required to certify it, because you're not substantially complete, so the architect says yes, you guys have to be pretty careful and understand what the project is and what the issues are to say substantial completion. And it can be somewhat subjective from time to time, but that's why it's an important date. And so we have this as far as time, the beginning to substantial. So when you start commencement to the substantial completion date, that's what's called the contract time. It's a 40-week project. That's from I first stepped on the project site to substantial completion. You may have another month and a half to get to final, but substantial completion is the contract time. That's what your schedule looks at. Time limits stated in the contracts are of the essence of this contract. And the contractor confirms that contract time is a reasonable period for performing the work. Time is of the essence is a legal concept. Legally, what time is of the essence says is any date on this project schedule, contractor, you must be bound legally to meet each date. So if there's a date when the cabinetry goes in, if there's a date when the windows go in, if there's a date when the ceiling's supposed to be installed, all those dates will be on a project schedule. The contractor, by this provision, as it sits here, as written, was responsible for meeting each and every one of those dates. And if they miss any of those dates, they could be considered in breach. So what will often happen in your career is they're going to say time is of the essence of this contract for major milestones as opposed to every single time in the whole calendar. So a major milestone is foundations are poured. Major milestone is the steel's up. Major milestone is the building's in dry in, so the building has now has an envelope, has a roof, has walls, and the windows are in, so now if it rains, it's dry on the inside. There's these different types of milestones that come up. That's not in this contract, but that's what you're going to see throughout your career. As you see when you see time of the essence, every single date on that schedule, the contractor must hit. So, and the contractor, is by this language, is confirmed. I looked at the schedule, it's fair and reasonable, I can make it. Most of the time, it's the contractor that makes the schedule anyway. They're going to be like, use my schedule. So, of course, they're going to say it's fair and reasonable because they should have built in their wiggle room to make those dates. They're the ones that are creating the schedule in most instances. The contractor shall not knowingly commence the work prior to the effective date of the insurance required and furnished by the contractor. So if the contractor says, I'm going to start July 1st, but they're still negotiating to get the right insurance for the project and the policy hasn't been issued for that project, contractor can't start. And that, but then, so they start July 15th. Well, now the project's already 2 weeks late. That's the contractor's problem. So, but this says, and the purpose of this is, you don't want anybody working on a project site without insurance, because if somebody gets hurt, yeah, that's what the insurance is for, to cover that. So you always tell the contractor, don't start early. And then 8223 says, contractor shall achieve substantial completion within the contract time. The contract time is defined by the schedule. Substantial completion is defined by when it's fit for its intended use and purposes. And so you have to finish everything by that time. This is even though we have time of the essence in 821, 823 really reiterates how important substantial completion is. 8.3, delays and extensions of time. If the contractor's delayed, happens a lot in projects, for whatever reason, at any time in the commencement of the progress of the work, by an act or neglect of the owner or the architect, or a separate contractor, changes order in the work, labor disputes, fire, usual things, sort of, et cetera, delay authorized by the owner pending mediation, or causes that the contractor asserts and the architect deems justified delay, the contract time shall be extended for such reasonable time as the architect may determine. So what does this mean? I've got a schedule that I put together as a general contractor. I've told you and I promise you, the owner, I will meet the dates on this schedule. But owner and architect, I gave you some samples of bricks that I wanted to know which brick you wanted to use for this brick wall, and you took 3 weeks to get me which brick color it is. I expected it back in 7 to 10 days. We had talked about that, and I didn't get it back. You have delayed me, so I should get an extension of my contract time. From the 7 to 10 days, that 3 weeks, whatever that 14, 15 extra days are, I should get an extension. Or your kitchen supplier, the separate contractor, your kitchen contractor, slowed me down because they were late. I should get an extension of my contract time. There's changes order in the work. We're adding that bathroom. I get a 3-week extension. Fire, unusual delays and deliveries, unavoidable casualties. These are what's called this concept of force majeure, act of God. I didn't cause the fire. I wasn't responsible for the floods, the locusts, the deliveries. Those things are not in my control. I get an extension of time. So these are a list of things by which the contractor can raise their hand and say, these aren't my fault, and it's delaying me, I should get an extension of time. Now what you see here is it doesn't say more money. It just says you get an extension of time. Contractors will ask for time and money here. They'll modify that. Could be fair, depending on what it is. And then I have a whole bunch of provisions, 831, 832, 833, 834, 835, that I add in to say, here are the rules if you want time and money. And here's what a force majeure is. And here's all these other things to help clarify this. But as a basic for this contract, it says, contractor's delayed, it's not its fault, they get more time. No money, just time. Okay? Any questions on time? All right. Do you guys want to take a quick break? All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll zip through the rest and get you guys out of here. Okay, continuing on. We're going to go to Article 9, which is payments and completion. Because I told you Article 9.8 was going to talk about substantial completion, but we've got to figure out how the contractor gets paid. So, we have a definition here of the contract sum, and that's the price that we agree upon. Hold on. At the beginning of the project, it's the total amount payable by the owner to the contractor for the performance of the work. And the work will be defined in the contract documents. It's a capital W. Unit prices are stated to the original contractor. They can substantially agreed upon if the quantity is originally completed or materially changes, substantial inequity. All you need to know about 9.2 is, like, sometimes instead of saying, I'm going to do all the plumbing work in this very complex building for X dollars, what it's going to say is, I'm going to supply PVC piping at X dollars per linear foot. So it's a unit, linear foot, and it costs so many cents per linear foot. So at the end of the project, however many linear feet you use, that's the price of the materials. That's a unit price. You use it for bricks, you use it for concrete, how many yards of concrete you pour. So there's a lot of things where unit prices come into projects. And so sometimes there may see some changes. There may be, okay, we think it's going to be around $1 million for your plumbing, but we're doing it based on unit prices. It may come in at $780,000. It may come at 1.2 because we all know the price of the linear feet of the plumbing, something to that effect. So that's a model that you can use for pricing certain things out. Schedule of values. This is a document that is very important. It's going to be on every single project. Now, here, it's not a capitalized term. And I sometimes will make it a capitalized term because I want that schedule of values to actually be a contract document. So I will come in, and there's only a dozen or so times when the schedule of values has been capitalized. Schedule of values is basically a list, and you can read what's up on here, but I'm going to just tell you what it is in a nutshell. There's going to be, on your contract, on your project, there's going to be a price for excavation, and there's a price for pouring foundations, and there's a price for all the steel that's going to go in, price for rough carpentry, price for finished carpentry, price for plumbing, price for electrical, and so forth and so on. Tiling, fixtures, finishes, painting, all those things have an individual line item. My excavator, the guy that comes in with the backhoe and digs the hole, is going to charge $100,000. So it's going to put the scope of the work, excavation, steel, foundation, plumbing, rough, finished carpentry, whatever it is. It's going to name the contractor that's going to be doing that work, and it's going to have a price. Now that price, if it's a lump sum contract, and when you do this whole project for $10 million, when you add all those prices up at the bottom, it's going to equal to $10 million. That price of $300,000 for digging that hole may not be exactly what the subcontractor bid, but it's a placeholder that the contractor put in, so you can manipulate some of the numbers. Or, if it's a project where it's actual time and material, you're going to see the actual cost. You're going to see the actual bids. That depends on how you put together your pricing model. But conceptually, the schedule of values is like an Excel spreadsheet. The first column is the scope of work. The second column is the subcontractor that's doing the work. The third column is the price. The fourth column will say how much work has been done to date. I have $300,000 for my excavation. I've dug two-thirds of the hole. I get paid $200,000. And then the last column says how much amount remaining owed, $100,000, because it'll add to $300,000. And you follow that and you track that. And every month, that schedule values is updated because work is done in every month. And eventually, some of those rows, once the excavation is all completed, it'll zero out. And you will pay the $300,000, and there'll be no more money in that line in the column. And as you work down throughout the project, all those items will ultimately zero out, and it should be $10 million if there's no change orders. That's what a schedule values is. It gives you the schedule of how much it costs, who's doing the work, and when it's being done. The architect, the point here that you want to do is in the middle, it says, the contractor's application for payment, that's their invoice. You use that schedule value as the architect, and changes to the schedule value shall be submitted to the architect and supported by data. So what happens is, we're on the project for the first month, and I've dug two-thirds of that hole, and a bunch of steel has arrived on site. And the formwork for all the foundations have arrived on site. So you're going to have three line items on the schedule values that will have changed in columns 5 and column 6. It'll show two-thirds, 200,000, remaining on the balance, 100,000. If for the steel, let's say it was $1 million worth of steel, and they had dropped off 50% of that, it'll say 500,000 steel dropped off, remaining balance. Those changes that happen every month, when the contractor submits their invoice, their application for payment, attached to it will be that schedule values updated. You as the architect are going to walk around the project site, you're going to check it out, and you'll be like, that's not 50% of the steel. I know how much steel is going to be on this project. It's only 30%. And you come back to the contractor and say, look, I know you're trying to get front-loading everything else, but I'm only going to pay you $300,000, not $500,000 off your million, because your schedule values is not accurate to what I've seen. I'm reviewing what's going on. I'm not checking to see if steel was properly manufactured. That's with the subcontractors. I'm not seeing how it was erected. I'm not doing the means and methods. But I'm getting a general sense of the progress of the project, and the schedule values will be adjusted proportionally from month to month to month. And that's what the architect is going to do and use that. And so it always changes. Schedule values is probably the most living, breathing document on a project because it changes every month. And you as the architect are going to be kind of the policeman to make sure that they are, the contractor is not asking for too much too early. It's interesting also, sometimes you're going to find where like I've had a project, it was for a convention center in a college. And the contractor was submitting their schedule of values, and one of the line items in the schedule of values has to do with the labor. And they had a huge, the project had a ton of work that needed to be done, but the cost of labor was really low. And they were somewhat delayed, maybe a couple weeks. And so the owner hired us to come in, and we brought in some scheduling people that took a look at it. And what we told them was, I think it was like a $30 million project, I don't remember exactly, but we told them, they were being told by the contractor we're on time, or we're a little bit delayed, but we're under budget, because look, we've only spent this much money. And what we were able to determine was the amount of work that had to be completed, the amount of time left, it would be physically impossible because they didn't have enough labor early on. So sometimes you can even use the schedule of values, if you're looking at the project schedules correctly, to see if the contractor has actually put enough workers to do the work at the right time. And so what we told the owners, we said, I know they're telling you that they're 2 weeks late. They're actually about 3 months late. And you guys are probably about $2 million over budget, because the only way to get on time is for them to have acceleration and double and triple crews and stacking and everything else, which we weren't responsible for doing. So the schedule values, you as the architect and working with schedules and everything else, can be very important just to see where the contractor is billing their money. Sometimes the contractor isn't doing their job. Sometimes they're not trying to get money in advance. They just haven't pushed it along far enough. So it's an important document. Okay, 9.3, applications for payment. The application for payment shall be submitted to the architect as an itemized application for payment prepared in accordance with the schedule values. So when I get the invoice, if the schedule values has 20 different line items, excavation, foundation, steel, the application for payment should have those same 20. That invoice should match what the schedule values looks like. And there's going to be a number of them at the bottom because you haven't gotten to finish carpentry or installing cabinetry or putting down floors. You're still digging the hole and building it. The ones at the bottom will still say zero, that they're asking for money. But they track. And so you as the architect look at the schedule values as a contract document, and you look at what the invoice says, and those should match as well as what you're seeing out in the field. 9.3.1.1. The applications may include requests for payments on account of changes in the work that have been properly authorized by a CCD, Constructive Change Directive. That's what I said. If it goes longer, this is where the application for payment, you can ask for money. If it's going to be 6 weeks or 8 weeks to build this change, you don't have to wait till the end of all that change is finished to bill. You bill intermittently as you go along on the regular month-by-month basis, and that'll be rolled into the application for payment under 9311. 9312, they shall not include requests for payments for portions of the work for the which contractor does not intend to pay a subcontractor. So sometimes you have a situation where subcontractor screws up on the installation of electrical, and your architect comes and says, this is wrong, it needs to be fixed. Contractor goes to the electrician and says, you need to fix your electrical. Then there's a squabble between them. The electrician doesn't come in. And it's going to delay the project. So the contractor brings in its own electrician and does the work. Now the contractor's out 30 grand. And there's a squabble between contractor and subcontractor. So the contractor takes that 30 grand and says, owner, pay me that 30 grand. Owner doesn't have to pay it. Because the owner's not responsible for the squabble that happens. If the owner, because you know the contractor's not going to pay the 30 grand to the sub, they didn't do the work. They had to pay for it themselves. So the owner, if the owner's already paid for it, this provision is to keep the owner from paying twice. Just because it's stuck on an application for payment doesn't mean the owner has to pay for it, especially if that money's not going to go from the general contractor down to the sub. I'm backcharging you, subcontractor. I had to pay somebody else to do and fix your crappy work, so I'm going to not pay you your next bill because unless you write me a check for that 30, I can't charge it to the owner. I'm charging it to you, but if you're not going to write me the check, then you got to keep working, and I'm not going to give you your next paycheck. I'm going to short you 30 grand. So whatever that squabble is and how they work out, owner doesn't have to pay for that, and that's what this provision protects the owner for. 9.2 just talks about storing stuff off the project site. You don't have to worry about that. 9.3.3, contractor warrants that all title to work covered in application for payment will pass to the owner no later than the time of payment. So, if a pump or an air conditioning unit or some piece of equipment arrives on site and that cost for that equipment is in an application for payment, as soon as the owner pays that application for payment, the owner now owns that pump or owns that air conditioning or whatever equipment is, even if it's not installed. And so what happens is, let's say there's that squabble between contractor and air conditioner supplier. Sometimes the air conditioner supplier comes in and takes their equipment because they haven't been paid, and they take it back. Well, the contractor, the title, the contractor by this is guaranteed, they warrant, the title is passed to the owner. So when that air conditioner contractor, subcontractor comes and takes the unit off the site, that's stealing because the owner has title to it. It's been transferred. So that's why you have to make sure payment happens all the time. Interesting thing about this, and it says it should be free of all liens, claims, and otherwise, so that's where that's a mechanism, mechanics lien that a subcontractor or supplier could put on their equipment. I had a project, or actually it was one of my partners that worked on this project, and they had a piece of equipment that was worth about $10 million. And there was a squabble, significant squabble between owner and contractor on timing and delays and everything else like that. So the equipment was supposed to arrive at a certain time. And the contractor, it was in an open area, the property was fenced off, but the contractor had leased on its own across the street a separate laydown area. That's where the workers parked and everything else. And the owner was not responsible for that. It wasn't in their cost and it wasn't in their property. So because of this squabble, the contractor had this piece of equipment supplier put it on pallets in this parking lot across the street. It's a $10 million piece of equipment. And didn't put it in the application for payment. So the owner didn't, quote unquote, pay for it. So it wasn't on the owner's land. And the owner didn't have title transfer to it. Now, the contractor could have installed it any time they wanted to, and then it would go on land. But they used that $10 million worth of equipment as leverage to resolve the dispute between the owner and the contractor over other costs. Because they said, here's your equipment, it's sitting there ready to go in, but you don't own it, and it's sitting there, and we say any delay because you haven't paid us for this work, we're not installing that because you've delayed us here. So you can use equipment as leverage, and the title hasn't passed because they didn't invoice us for it. Sometimes they invoice it before it even shows up on site, and this provision says I have title, so get it here and put it on site. So there are games at play, and that's just part of business, but this one, as its clear basis is, you pay for it, you own it. That's good. Certificate for payment. So there's an application for payment. That's what the contractor gives, the invoice. Here's my application for payment. The architect has to certify it, so they give a certificate of payment. So the architect will show within 7 days after receipt of the contractor's application for payment, shall either issue to the owner a certificate of payment in the full amount of the payment, or two, determine if there's an issue that there's amounts that the architect determines are properly due, notify the owner contractor that they were withholding parts of it, or three, withhold certificate in its entirety. So you can get, you know, there's 25 line items on there, and you can say, yes, this work is done, this is good, this is good. Well, you're only 30% done, you say you're 50%. I'm going to approve 30%, but not 50. So you're withholding on that $1 million contract $200,000. You're going to notify everybody that, so you're certifying some, but not all. And that withholding means the owner doesn't have to pay. When the architect signs, and here's what I certify, and this giant application for payment that is $4.6 million, and I only certify 1.4 because I'm holding that $200,000 back for the excavation, owner only has to pay the 1.4 because that's what's been certified. That's when you take that invoice, application payment, you walk around and say, yes, 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 no, not enough. I'm going to reduce that. Or, as it says under 3, this is completely ludicrous, and there's all these problems on the project site. You're double billing, there's this or that. I'm not going to certify it at all. You don't see number 3 happen as often, but sometimes it'll happen at the end of the project when things get skewed and the contractor's asking for a lot more money because of delays or whatever, and it's who's at fault. And so sometimes the owner's like, if I pay you, I'm never getting it back. You can sue me for not paying you, or we can try to work this out. Architect, don't certify that last payment application or whatever. So there's, again, some leverage points that are used with this. But your job in the basic provisions of this agreement under 9.4 is you get to certify it, and you have to do it within a week. 9.4.2, the issuance of the certificate of payment will constitute a representation by the architect to the owner. Not to the contractor, architect to the owner, that based on, and look at this, to the best of your knowledge, information, and belief. You remember that from the B101? Same thing. And we talked about how you certify payments in the B101. Here's one of these mirror images. So the contractor says, hey, it's the best of their knowledge, information, and belief. I'm not mandating or guaranteeing that all these things happen. It's just to the best of my knowledge. I don't have x-ray vision. I can't see behind the wall. But I'm pretty sure the plumbing's there. So I'm going to certify this line item for the plumbing. I don't know that. It's the best of my knowledge, information, and belief. So that's what 9.4.2 is. 9.4.2 continued. We're going to see the same language you saw in the other one. Even though you get that certificate of payment, it is not a representation by the architect to the owner again that they've made exhaustive and continuous on-site inspections. You may be there only once a week, or twice or once a month. You're not there every day. So you're not making continuous on-site inspection. You are not reviewing the means, methods, sequences, materials, and procedures. You're not part of that. That was the same in the B101. You haven't reviewed the copies of the requisitions from subcontractor suppliers, and you haven't made an examination to determine for what purpose the contractor has used the money. So you are not certifying that all these things happen. You are within the boundaries of basically, I see an application for payment, I walk around to the best of my knowledge, it looks fair and reasonable, I'm not going to get into the contractor's problems with their subs, I'm not going to see what they're doing with their money, we hope they're making payments, but I say contractors owed 1.4 on this $1.6 million application for payment. Owner, based on my best knowledge, information, and belief, you can write the check for 1.4. And then you're out. Well, you've done your job. If there's all these squabbles going on, and there's liens, and all these other stuff can file, as long as you've done your knowledge, your job and best knowledge, you as the architect are not responsible. And this language in this agreement is for the contractor to understand. The contractor can't point fingers and say, hey, the architect approved this, so of course the work was done. Of course we need to pay for it. It must be right. I didn't double bill. I didn't do any of these things. The contractor can't blame the architect because the architect didn't know all these shenanigans that are going on behind the scenes. And that does happen. you will find scenarios where cases where contractors will say, the architect approved payment, so obviously the work must have been done correctly. And this says, no, I'm not looking at these methods techniques. If that wall falls down 2 days later, just because the architect says you get paid for it doesn't mean it's the architect's fault. They didn't see behind the walls that there was no place for where the studs were. So of course it's going to fall down, or whatever the problem is. So this tells the contractor the architect is limited in what they're doing for certifying, but it also tells the contractor they're only going to certify for what is fair and reasonable. Okay? 9.5, decisions to withhold certifications. So now we have some rules. When can you do it? You can withhold to the extent necessary to protect the owner. All of these things you're doing to protect or on behalf of the owner, but not as the authority of the owner. You're telling the owner, you're notifying it, you're telling the owner you're certifying it, and then the owner makes the decision from there. And if you're unable to certify the payment and the amount of the application, the architect will notify everybody, as provided in 9.1. And if the architect and contractor cannot agree on a revised amount, the architect will issue the certificate of payment for which the architect is able to make the representation. I see, contractor, you're asking for 1.6. I'm not going to certify it for 1.6. I'm only going to certify for 1.4. Contractor says, hold on, let me tell you this, this, and this, and they still have a discussion. If they can't come to an agreement, it stays at the 1.4. Everybody knows that money is flowing, and the contractor can bring a claim under Article 15 on the additional $200,000 if he wants to. So, one of the things that will happen, I don't think it's in this provision, what I often put in 9.5 or in 9.4.1, again, won't be an exam, but this is the process, it's what's called a pencil draw. So if the payment application is due, let's say, on the last day of the month, you add an additional paragraph that says 7 days before, or maybe 10 days, whatever you want to do, contractor's going to give a pencil draw, meaning it's not in ink. We can erase it. And then you have the contractor and the architect sit down in a meeting and go through each and every number. And so you try to get those numbers correct. And so when you see the $500,000 for the excavation and it only should be $300,000, you have that discussion before the final true application for payment is put in ink. So you have this pencil draft, you have a discussion, so when the true application is submitted, we're already all in agreement. And then we all know what the money's going to flow. That is a process that happens on bigger jobs all the time, this pencil draw. And it just backs it up one more week or 10 days to allow them to talk about it, so when you actually get the true application for payment, the numbers are all correct. So that's something that happens. Did you have a question? Okay. Let's see. Withhold. Okay. 9.1 continued. The architect may also withhold certificate of payments because of subsequently discovered evidence may nullify from a certificate previously issued. And then there's a list here of defective work, third-party claims, improper payments to subcontractors, damages, evidence that there was that it can't be completed for the unpaid work, some other things. There's a number of things here. So here's what happens in this thing. Architect approves the $1.4 million of the payment application number 3. Contractor wanted 1.6. So we get to the final agreement, owner writes a check for 1.4. The next week comes, and or the next month comes, there's a whole bunch of other stuff on there, but it turns out that the excavation work wasn't done very well. And the mud slopping in, or it's not the right size and shape. And so that two-thirds of it was done, wasn't done properly, but it wasn't observable as the architect wandered the project site. You've already paid them for that. Somebody's got to fix it. The owner shouldn't have to pay twice. You've got to bring that excavator, come back in and fix it and everything else. So when that next application for payment comes in, and you've figured out that it's going to cost $100,000 to fix what you already approved, you can withhold from anywhere in the application for payment $100,000 based on defective work. I approved work that now I have new evidence that it wasn't done properly. I didn't know it at the time, but now I've discovered it wasn't, so I'm going to hold $100,000 that I incorrectly paid you. So it gives you some leverage. Or maybe that electrician files a mechanic lien on the property and says, hey, I've got the squabble going with my contractor. I got a bunch of work on the project. Now I've got a lien sitting on it. You, as the owner, say, I'm not paying that $30,000 twice. So I'm going to withhold $30,000 from the next payment until you guys figure out your squabble. So this allows the owner to, in conjunction with the architects, to make sure that the money that's going into the contractor's hand is fair for the work that was properly completed and timely completed and was not in violation of the rules of the contract where a subcontractor causes a lawsuit or the contractor's not paying people, whatever. If you become aware, whether it's the architect or the owner, of these shenanigans or these problems that are happening, that next payment application, you hold on to that money. That's what this is for. And this comes in, as I said, often at the end of the project when like everybody's trying to get the math to work out and you say, well, you're asking for way too much and there's not that much left in the job. I'm just going to withhold everything and we'll figure it out from there and see who's really owed what. And that'll happen on projects toward the end. 954, if the architect withholds certification for payment under 95313, the owner may, as a sole option, issue joint checks to the contractor and any subcontractor. So let's say there's this squabble going on between contractor and electrician, this $30,000 squabble, and you actually have liked the electrician's work, and the project that you're doing is moving into a building that's owned by, you know, it's a commercial building. Your office is being built out. So now the plumber has been slighted $30,000 from the general contractor, or the electrician. The electrician's been slighted $30,000 from the general contractor. The electrician puts a lien on the entire building. So they don't care what floor it is. They're putting a lien on the whole building. You're just a renter of the building, and you're having it built out for your office space. Your landlord says, your lease says you're not allowed to have a lien on this building, and if you don't clear this lease up in 30 days, we're going to cancel your lease. But that's for many leases. If you have construction on my project, don't you screw up my property. So if you get a lien, you're responsible, and you clear that title in 30 days. So now you're sitting there, and you're like, I already paid the general contractor the 30. I don't want to pay him twice. I don't know what the squabble is, but I need this lien gone. This allows you to write a two-party check to the contractor and the subcontractor. The subcontractor knows I'm getting money, I'm getting my 30 grand, and the general contractor, both they have to sign off, so it forces them to try to resolve the dispute, and you can use that evidence to get the lien removed. So this allows the owner to protect its property interest and go around sometimes that squabble between contractor and subcontractor. I've had projects where a fight with the subcontractor isn't on my project, it's a different project that the contractor has with a sub down the road. So it's the same GC on both projects, same subcontractor on both projects. And they're squabbling at a project down the road, and that subcontractor's owed money, but they've already been paid. So the general contractor on my project says, I overpaid you down there, screw you, I'm not going to pay you here. I'm the owner, it's like, that's not my fault. So I go around them and I make sure the subcontractor's paid for my work and say, you guys figure that mess out yourself, but I'm going to keep my property clean and clear with this two-party check thing. So, and I've used this often in trying to resolve at the end of projects when there's lots of disputes. I had one time where we had 25 different subcontractors and I think we issued two-party checks to 18 of them just to get the thing done and over. So it's a good provision to have. 9.6, progress payments. Contractors should pay each subcontractor no later than 7 days, this is 9.62, after receiving the payment from the owner, and the contractor shall, by appropriate agreement with each subcontractor, require that they make those payments to the sub-subs in a similar amount. This is a pay-when-paid clause. There's two things, pay if paid and pay when paid. So after the general contractor has been paid, when the general contractor has been paid, they need to pay their subs within 7 days. Because the subs are going to be on kind of a rolling basis. The subs don't get paid before the GC gets paid, so their payments are always due 7 days later or 10 days later or whatever. This mandates that the money keeps flowing, that the general contractor doesn't sit on it. And if the general contractor owes the sub and goes longer than 7 days and a lien falls on it, general contractor's fault. So this is to keep the money moving, and it's a mandate. It's a mandatory pay when paid. And so then the contractor says, hey, by the way, subs, you have to do it with your sub-subs. So when that wood supplies them, the wood arrives on the audience, on the land, the property, or the equipment arrives on the property, contractor gets paid within 7 days, pays the sub, and within 7 days from there pays the vendor. That just keeps the money flowing so your project doesn't get bogged down. 9th Street just talks about this percentage complete. There's a concept that, you know, I'm 30%, 50% done with my excavation. So it's a benchmark to show how far along you're doing it. This happens most commonly in lump sum projects, but you'll see it in all different projects. So the owner and the architect have a feel of where the project is in the schedule, how much is completed based on a percentage. Sometimes the percentage is based solely on how much money's been paid out, but sometimes it's actual the work that's been performed. Yes.
At that point, when the GC is paid, would there already be, like, I'm trying to think of, like, are there reasons for what might take them longer to pay their sub besides them just, like, being reluctant? Or is it, like, at that point, when the GC is paid, all the work of the sub is already kind of
That's an excellent question. The answer is yes, it should be, because what happens is, for the general contractor to put their application for payment together, that is based on invoices already received from the subs. So that material, all that information of how much wood has been supplied, how much labor has been done, all of that should have already been provided by the subs, and those documents should be accurate and fair, and then the general contractor rolls that into the application for payment and gives it to the owner. So the subs have already billed and they're waiting. Now the owner pays the general contractor 20 days, 30 days later, whatever that basis is. Now we've had that invoice has been sitting in with the sub probably for already a week plus 30. So they're already going to be, sometimes the subs are minus 60 days back until they get paid. And it should be, unless there's some squabble about the quality of work or the other project or whatever, it should be simply an accounting that when that check hits the contractor's bank, within 7 days all the checks should be cut, because those decisions of those values were already decided to create that application for payment. That's what should happen. Doesn't always happen that way. And one of the things that's difficult about subs is because they often start a project and they are often at a minimum of 60 days before they get paid, because they got to do their work. They got to submit that to the contractor. The contractor gives it to the owner. The owner gets to review it and pays 30 days later. Well, that work done on January 1st isn't going to get paid till the end of February, because the bill comes at the end of January. So the end of February check comes, and then there's 7 more days. So now, work that I did January 1st as a sub, I might not be paid till March 7th. So that's sometimes why subs are always, like, you know, hand them out, and are really the ones that they are at the mercy of the general contractor. And so when the general contractor says, I'm only going to pay you 80 cents of the dollar, they're going to take that money because they need to get paid. So that's where some of the, like I said, I keep using the word shenanigans, I've got to come up with something that's actually a little more contemporary. But anyway, that's where some of those games start happening, where the subcontractors get stringed along and along because they've been sitting out, they've done the work, and so it's in how you put their business model together and everything else. But that's a good question. 964, I think we did this, right? Yeah. Payment bond, we don't have to worry about bonds. Oh, did we just not? Okay, let's go back, 964. The owner has the right to, oh yeah, right. The owner has the right to request written evidence from the contractor that the contractor has probably paid the subcontractor. If the contractor fails to furnish some evidence within 7 days, the owner shall have the right to contact the subs and suppliers themselves. So this would happen if that electrician filed a lien on the property. You know, you're not there as the owner nor the architect to try to figure out what's going on between the GC and the subs, because you already have a provision that says pay them within 7 days. And I don't care about your problems with it. As long as my architect says the work's looking good and it works and then we're fine with it, I'm going to pay you general contractor and you keep your house in order. Now all of a sudden you get a lien on your property, or you get a subcontractor calling you. I mean, there are plenty of times where the subcontractor will call an owner and say, why am I not getting paid? And the owner will have no idea what they're talking about. Well, I've already paid for your work. I see it on your application, the contractor's application for payment. So in those instances, 964 says, I'm allowed now, even though I don't have to, I can tell the contractor, open up your books. Let me see behind the curtain. Why is the sub doing this? And if they fail to furnish that, now I can call the subcontractor directly and say, let me see your accounting and tell me what's the problem. This is to protect the owner from the contractor playing games with your subcontractors. So the problem with this one is most owners, especially like in the residential market, they don't know what to do when the subcontractor calls. So they go and they yell at the general contractor. They have no idea they have these rights. Even sophisticated owners that are relying on the general contractor but they don't have an owner's rep don't know some of these things because they signed this contract and they stuck it in a drawer. This is a good provision to protect an owner. And so this is something that you as the architect, when things start to get squirrely on a project, remember this provision and tell the owner, hey, you can look behind the curtains here. Look at 964 and ask them to do that. And if not, we can figure out that for you. And you can, as the architect, if you're the one making the phone calls, you can charge them for that. That's an additional service or supplemental service. I'm going to go do some homework for you and investigate this. My hourly rate's 120 hours or 250 an hour or whatever. You're doing the owner service because it's a lot cheaper for you to do it than hiring me. But it's something that you should remember when projects get a little bit off, that the owner has this right. 966, a certificate of payment, a progress payment, or partial or entire use or occupancy by the project shall not constitute acceptance of the work that's not in accordance with the contract document. This is a really, really critical provision. This says, yes, I paid you. Yes, my architect looked at your application for payment and certified it. Yes, I moved in the building and I'm making candy. That doesn't mean that if your work was crappy, I've accepted it. Payment and use and certification doesn't mean that you get to get away from crappy work. I can still sue you, or I can bring a warranty claim for your crappy work, even though I paid you for it, because I paid you to give me good work. This is a very important provision. And this is one, like I said, sometimes the contractor is going to say, well, the architect approved my payment application, so it should have been approved, and it's good, and it's accepted. It's like, no, it's still crappy work. Just because I paid you doesn't mean I'm the contractor. Because if that was the case, if the contractor had just said, you paid me, so I'm good, they could put up a lot of smoke and mirrors on projects and everything else. And when it falls down, they're like, not my problem, you paid me, you accepted it. That doesn't happen, and that shouldn't happen. So, acceptance is not tied to payment or use. On the owner's side, there's a provision up here on the contractor side, acceptance of payment flips, and the contractor is bound by that. So, payment bonds, 967, we don't have to worry about. 968, provided the owner has fulfilled its payment obligations, as long as I've paid you, the contractor shall defend and indemnify owner from all loss, liabilities, damages, expense, including reasonable attorney's fees, litigation, blah, 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 arising from any lien claim or any claim of payment. This says, if I paid you that $30,000 for the electrical work, and the electrician files a lien on my property, you, contractor, have to pay for the defense, and it's not my problem. You have to figure out and correct your mistakes, and whatever your problem is with your electrical sub, it's not my issue. And if I have to hire a lawyer, you got to pay my lawyer. And if I have to go to court, you have to pay my time at court. And if it costs me more money out of the pocket of $30,000 that I've already paid, you have to pay me that back. That's what this provision is for. This is another very powerful provision, but the basis is, I'm only going to pay for once. I don't have to pay for twice. Your job is to make sure it's done correctly the first time. 9.7. If the architect does not issue a certificate of payment through no fault of the contractor, within 7 days after receipt, blah, 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 or the owner doesn't pay within 7 days after there's been a certification of the payment, the contractor may, upon 7 additional days, give notice to the architect and stop work until the payment of the proper amount has been received. So, let's say we're at this $1.6 million pay application and the architect certifies $1.4 million, and the contractor's adamant that they did 50% of the excavation. If the contractor can prove that I've done 50% of the excavation but only gets $1.4 million and demands an additional $200,000, and the owner says no, The contractor can stop work on seven days' notice. Hey, I've proved it. Here's the evidence. It's a 10 by 10 square. I've done 10 by 5. That's 50%. Give me my money. If you don't get that additional $200,000, I'm going to stop work. Owner should probably give the money. So this gives some rights back to the contractor. We talk a lot about rights to the owner, but this gives the contractor, hey, pay me for what I'm owed. This is fair. I'm not trying to cheat you. This is what I did. So, and there could be squabbles over this, but this is something, because there's give and take in this agreement. This B1, this A201 says, hey, contractor has rights too. Substantial completion. The stage of the progress of the work when the work designated portion can be occupied, used, utilized for its work and its intended use. So that's this, so it's not the exact language that fits for its intended use and purposes, but this is what we've said. There's a process here. That's what 982 says. When the contractor considers the work or a portion, sometimes like buildings can be substantially complete in sections, that they are substantially complete, they should prepare and submit to the architect a list of items completed or to be corrected for final payment. So they're going to say, they're going to raise their hand, say, hey, I'm substantially complete. Here, architect, this is the only list of things that we think needs to be done. This is what's called a punch list. Yeah, I got some paint to touch up. I got some cover plates. I got some lighting, some light bulbs need to be screwed in, blah, blah, blah. But here's all my minor stuff. But this building is ready to roll. We're ready to rock. Here's my substantial completion. I raised my hand. So they're the ones that are going to start the process first. Contractors are going to raise their hand. And as I said, sometimes in a project, like let's say you're doing a condo building, and you start, maybe you want to lease the top, you want to sell the top three first because they're the most expensive. So it's a 9-story condo building and you go every 3 sections of floors. I'm going to substantially complete the top 3 and those are going to be finished out. Now I can get money in and I can get the people there and I can get paid. So you could have partial substantial completions for different buildings. Or if you know it's a big campus and you have different portions of the building, the whole project is 20 buildings, but you can do 5 and 5 and 8 and 6 or whatever it might be. That's how you can, that cuts 24 or so, but that's how you do partial substantial completions for different buildings. But it's always the contractor that raises their hand first. That's under 982. And then 983 says, once I got the contractor's list, the architect's going to walk around and make this determination of whether it's substantially complete. I'm going to walk around and say, yeah, I look at the drawings, I look at the project, yeah, I think we can rock. I think we can start making candy. And you're right, we got to put some cover plates and we got some floors that got some minor cracking and there's some things we got to clean up. But yeah, I'm going to certify substantial completion, and that's what it says. The contractor shall, before the issuance of certificate of completion, correct any items. So if the architect says, well, there's a few things that really are substantive you got to fix. It's not just cover plates and vinyl bases. There's a couple things you really got to fix, like the blower for that chiller is not working properly, and when we make candy, if the humidity's not right, it's going to screw up the candy and be too sticky when it dries. This is an actual thing that happens. Like they have humidity and they have circulation, humidity, and temperature in all the floors of Haribo, and it has to be within a certain bandwidth. And if it doesn't, the candy doesn't work and they got to throw it out. So if those chillers aren't blowing the proper air and moving it enough at the proper speed, then you say, contractor, you're not substantially complete. Fix that. And once you fix that, we're good. Boom, I'll give you a certificate. So that's this process. So, but if you're all at substantial completion, then you move into the punch list. So this process allows the architect to walk around, say yay or nay on your substantial completion. If it's yes, we move to punch list. If it's no, the contractor has to fix a few more things. And then I go back and recertify substantial completion. And if you remember, in Article 4.2.3 of the B101, it had those three lines. One is how many times a week I'm going to be on the project site, how many times I'm going to review samples and submittals, and the last one was how many times am I going to walk around for substantial completion. And the blanket filled in, and often it's 2 for that. So if you walk around twice as the architect, and you get to the second time and it's still not substantially complete, the next time you have to do it, you charge the owner. And then the owner back charges the contractor. So that's one thing. But that's how this ties into that provision 4.2.3 in the B101. 984, when it's deemed substantially complete, they're going to issue that certificate and they're going to establish a date. This is the date. Warranty start, returning over retainage, a whole bunch of other stuff. That's what happens under 984. We're substantially complete. We're good. 985, I should make a payment. this talks about, so the bottom of 984 says warranty start. The bottom of 985 talks about retainage, which I'll talk about in a second of what retainage is. Partial occupancy, I'm going to move on that. We can, sometimes you can get into a building early, like I said, if you put different floors and different sections, so you can do that. And it's not, again, it's not acceptance under 993. Final completion and final payment. So now, project is substantially complete. How do we get to final completion? Well, that's the, when you walk around, the contractor says, hey, now I'm finally complete. I put all the cover plates in. I put the vinyl bases. I fixed all the light bulbs and all this other stuff. And the architect will make yet another inspection. And they're going to come back with their punch list, and they're going to say, yes, 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 no. Maybe there's three or four things that aren't done. And that's the process that happens. I will tell you, like, one of the big cases that I had, it was a residential project. When the contractor said they were substantially complete, they weren't even remotely close to substantially complete, and the punch list had 1,600 line items. It was so bad. So these are sometimes where the contractor just didn't do their job, and you know they didn't do their job, and you kind of have to take care of it. But what 910 does is it has the architect, just like with substantial completion, walk around and give a certificate of payment for final completion. And that's that last check, the very last check that will be submitted by the owner to the contractor. But again, 910.2, neither final payment nor release of any retained percentage shall become due until the contractor submits the architect an affidavit that everybody else has been paid, that the insurance is in effect, and a statement that they know no reason why the insurance will not be renewable. So basically, the contractor has a list of things to get that final checklist. It's not to say I just put, not only did I put in all the vinyl plates and the punch and the cover plates for the vinyl flooring, molding, the vinyl molding, and the cover plates and the light bulbs, but I'm going to give you this list of things. Here are the warranties that are being turned over to you. Here's the insurance that was in place. Here's all the things that you need. It's a turnover book. That's a package that often comes in binders. And so some projects you have a very detailed list of what goes in that. So that's what 910 talks about. Or 910.2. Okay, 910.3. If after substantial completion, final completion is delayed through no fault of the contractor, so maybe the architect is kind of slow on what they're doing, that affects final completion, and the architect confirms this, whatever the issue is, the owner shall, application for by the contractor and certification by the owner, pay the balance due. So the project may not be finally complete, but if it's not the contractor's problem, they still should get paid. You know, it's not my problem, contractor's problem, if you, owner, have some issues going on your side with your kitchen architect and your kitchen contractor, all these other things, I should get paid out for my work. That's 910.3. 910.4, this is where I said is the opposite, where it talks about what the final payment is. Making a final payment shall constitute a waiver of claims by the owner, except if there are liens brought later, failure of the work to comply with the contract documents, you can always sue for bad work, terms of special warranties, or any audits. If you go back and audit and find out that the contractor has overcharged you, you haven't waived that claim because you've given final payment. But all the other minor things, as far as squabbles between a change order value and not, you've waived the dollar figures on that. So, that's it on 9. Anything on 9? Trying to get you guys out of here. 10, safety precautions and programs. I'm going to zip through this as much as I can, and then we're going to skip 11 because it's insurance. We've already done that. But not surprisingly, as the architect was not responsible for any safety, the contractor is. The contractor should be responsible for initiating, maintaining, supervising all safety precautions and programs in connection with the performance of the contract. So it's the contractor takes it, all the responsibility of safety. And they have to provide and prevent damage, injury to persons, to employees, to the materials, to the property adjacent. So everything that has to do with the project. They are responsible for all the safety on the project sites under 10.1 and 10.2. Not the owner, not the contractor. Now, an owner will often get sued if someone gets injured because of a safety issue because they ultimately own the property. And there can be questions of whether the owner made sure that the contractor was following the contract. And so the owner doesn't always get away 100% with the safety issues, but by and large, it should be the contractor's responsibility. If you have a bad scaffolding that's erected and it falls down, the scaffolding, and people are hit and hurt and close head injuries, which I've had that very project on a building downtown, I won't name the building, but the scaffolding collapsed. He was just a laborer. All his job was to bring masonry up. He wasn't installing. He'd go up an elevator and drop off masonry pieces, go down the elevator, get more, come up, just back and forth. Nice guy. It collapsed on him. Close head injury. He had to be taken care of for life because he basically had the mentality of about a six-year-old. It was really tragic for the family. The owner of the building wasn't responsible. Solely the contractor and the subcontractor that erected the scaffolding. So, based on these provisions here. They sued my client with the architect. They sued the architect, they sued the owner, they sued everybody, but ultimately it was the general contractor who was responsible for. Contractors should comply with and give notices required by all applicable laws, statutes, ordinances, OSHA, whatever it is. This basically says in 10.2.2, you've got to follow the law. And you, contractor, are responsible for knowing what the law is. So whatever laws that have to do with safety, your job, you own it, you're responsible for it. And if you didn't know it, it's not my problem, it's yours, because that's your job under 10.2.2. 10.2.5. The contractor shall property remedy damage or loss to property referred to in sections 10.2.1.2 and 10.2.1.3, caused in whole by the contractor, a subcontractor, subsubs, or anybody directly or indirectly liable for them, such and such. Basically, it says if there are problems on the project that are caused by the contractor, safety otherwise, the contractor is responsible for remedying it. They may flow this cause downstream to their subs, but according to the owner, contractor has to fix those problems. We don't go about 10.2.6, 10.2.7, 10.2.8. Injury or damage to person or property. If either party suffers injury or damage, notice of the injury or damage, whether or not insured, shall be given to the other party within a reasonable time not exceeding 21 days. This is a provision to say if someone gets hurt on the project site or there's property damage on the project site and you're going to make a claim against me, let me know and don't sit on it. Because if you don't let me know, there's all these issues with insurance companies not getting timely notice and denying coverage. So this is, again, to make sure that there's communication between the parties. I imagine if somebody's hurt on a project site, everybody's going to know anyway, but there has to be notice given so the parties are communicating. 10.3, hazardous materials. Contractors responsible complying with any of the requirements of the contract documents, meaning, hey, follow all the rules about hazardous materials. But here's an interesting thing. If the contractor encounters a hazardous material substance that's not notified in the subcontract documents, and if reasonable cautions will be inadequate to prevent foreseeable bodily injury or death, blah, 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 the contractor shall immediately stop work on the affected areas and notice the architect of the condition. I don't remember if I told you, when we were working on Navy Pier, to the east of Navy Pier in that North Pier area, there had been a watch factory that used made glow-in-the-dark watches, and they used thorium on those watch dials to create the glow-in-the-dark. Thorium is a radioactive material that they don't use anymore, but they would dump the excess of thorium in all the sand in the lot, and most of it was dumped at Navy Pier. Nobody knew that. This happened like 75, 80 years ago. Nobody knew about that. So when they started digging holes in Navy Pier and doing stuff, they discovered thorium. They did some soil samples and like, oh my God, we have a radioactive material. It's a very low radioactive. It's not actually something that, it's not like plutonium and uranium, but it still could cause problems. So it's a hazardous material in the soil. Contractor in that case immediately stops because this provision said they could. Call up the owner, and we had to bring people in. We had to bring in the Illinois EPA, the US EPA. We had to do investigations. McCormick Place owns the land. We had to bring them in. I was in. I brought in the lawyers in. And the project had to stop, and we had to reshift the schedule. And so there was an area where all the thorium was discovered that they didn't work on for a number of months. And the reshifting the schedule changed the schedule. Contractor got more money, more time, because they followed this provision. There's a hazardous material that we have to stop for. And that's actually, again, fair and safe. It's kind of the same thing like what happened in McCormick Place down on the lakeside. When they started originally digging that, they found Indian burial grounds. They had to stop because it's not a hazardous material, but it's Indian burial grounds. So, under 10.3.2, they have to bring in, the owner has to bring in a licensed laboratory. It's their job to fix the things and say what's going to happen. Sometimes the owner is responsible for cleanup. Sometimes the owner may say, contractor, here's the responsibility of how to do it. Do you want to do it? So there's a communication. And sometimes the contractors will take it on. Sometimes they won't. And 10.3.2 talks about that process. 10.3.3, this is where the owner has to indemnify the contractor or subs against claims related to that bodily injury, that hazardous material. So let's say it wasn't thorium. Let's say it was some type of gas leak or something that came in and people got some type of gas inhalation and burned their lungs out or whatever, and there was injury to them. Or there was an explosion and it blew up like a crane that the contractor was renting. Owner, because it was on the property and nobody knew about it, the owner's responsible for indemnifying and holding harmless the contractor. In that case, it's the owner's responsibility because the owner has the land. This is the one time, or one of the few times, intellectual property is the other one, but where the owner is the one writing the check to the contractor for the injury, as opposed to the contractor writing the check to the injured party and the owner their tag. So this is the flip side of that. 10.3.4, the owner should not be responsible to the section for hazardous materials that the contractor brings on site. And such substances are not required by the contract documents. So let's say that you have, they bring in a diesel generator before the electrical lines come to a property project. And they're the beginning stages, but they have to power the lights, they have to power, if it's being construction during the winter, they have to power the heat and whatever they need. So they have a diesel generator. Well, that diesel generator leaks, and all of a sudden now there's diesel oil and fuel that's going into the ground. That's hazardous materials that the contractor brought on site. You can't have that leakage of the fuel and diesel into the ground. The EPA is going to come in, or OSHA will come in. That could cause a fire. It's another hazard. Contractor's responsible for paying those costs of cleanup. So it just depends. The general rule of thumb you want to think about it is if it's in the land and it existed in the land, the owner's problem. If the contractor brought it on site, contractor's problem. The one exception is if the architect has something in their design that requires the contractor to bring in some type of hazardous material. Maybe it's a special kind of chemical that they use to peel the paint off of bricks, and the architect specifies a special chemical that turns out to be hazardous. Well, now the architect has instructed the contractor to do it, and somebody gets, again, sick from this chemical. Then the architect's going to have responsibility because they were the ones that mandated this chemical, and it wasn't the owner and it wasn't the contractor. So that's the rare occasion where the architect specifies hazardous material, but sometimes it happens. 10.3.5 says the contractor has to reimburse the owner for those costs for remediation and removal, and you know they have to take it to a landfill and they have to pay OSHA, the EPA, or whatever those costs are. So it's not going to be just digging it up and carting it out. There's going to be other fines and penalties that comes. And then so that's just the contractor. So the contractor has to pay the owner back for that. So that is Article 10. 11 we're skipping because we already did a whole section on insurance. 11 is just insurance. So I'm going to skip through insurance. There's really nothing in here other than to say, here's what I say about insurance. The H201 language for the insurance is decent. But every project is different. And so an insurance is a very complex mechanism, a complex that it changes every year. The AIA documents change once every 10 years. So they do their best. This is not a criticism of the AIA. They do their best to kind of put in a general, basic 101 of what insurance needs to be there. It's not nearly, it's not insurance for dummies, but it's insurance 101. So when you sign the contract, because you're building a house and you don't have a lawyer and everybody else, we have some things in there. So it's not blank and empty. But if you are an architect and you're working with an owner on a project that's, in my opinion, $1 million or above, or certainly $5 million and above, tell your lawyer or tell your owner, I'm not going to give you advice on insurance. You need to call your lawyer on this to get the right insurance in place. Because you're spending $5 million on this project, spend the right amount of money to get the right insurance in place. Because the AIA language is just general, and you need some specifics. It's not a criticism of the AIA. It's just they do the best they can because they're regulated every 10 years. And so keep up to date with the most current stuff. That's going to be the attorneys. So That's not a plug for me to get new work. It's a recommendation so that the owners are protected. Article 12, where are we in time? Okay, good. Let me get to this. Uncovering work. If the portion of the work is uncovered contrary to the architect's request, and it's in writing and covered by the architect's examination to replace the contractor's expense without a change in the contract time. This is that time, remember under the B-101 you had authority to inspect. I'm not sure if the plumbing was done correctly. I can tell the contractor to tear down that drywall and inspect. I can ask them to uncover the work. And if it's required in writing, if it must be uncovered by the architect, it has to be replaced at the contractor's expense without change in the contract time. So they have to do it for free and for no additional time. But that's only if the architect is correct in their investigation, if you remember from the B-101. And then it says in 12.1.2, if the portion of the work has been covered by the architect that has not been specifically requested to be examined, blah, blah, blah. If such work is not in accordance with the contract documents at the end, the cost of the recovering work and the cost of correction shall be at the contractor's expense. So that's when it says, if it's screwed up, 12.1.2 says the contractor's to pay for it. 12.1.3, I don't get there. Hold on. 12.1.3. Can I probably click the word? Oh. 12.2.1 says you have to correct work rejected by the architect prior to substantial completion. So if I walk around, you've raised your hand and said it's substantially complete, and the architect doesn't agree, well, this chiller isn't working properly, it's not blowing the air properly. Contractor has to do that before substantial completion. So this is this language of the contractor to say, hey, architect can tell you you're not substantially complete because you have to do X, Y, and Z to get there. After substantial completion, 12.2.2, so now we've met substantial completion. The warranties have kicked in. So we're in this warranty period going about a year. The owner shall give notice promptly after discovery of a condition. So there's a defect that they find after they moved in. And during a one-year period for correction of work, that's when the contractor should come in and fix it for free. So the warranty period says, if I move in, and within 1 year I find out my roof leaks, and I tell the contractor within that 1 year, contractor has come in and fixed the roof for free. If I don't give the contractor that claim within 1 year, I've waived my warranty rights to make a claim to require the contractor to correct it for free. That doesn't mean that the contractor gets away with it. Let's say I move into my house, starts leaking on month 10, and I forget to call the contractor until 3 months later. Now we're in month 13. Contractor's like, I'm sorry, the roof is out of warranty. Well, it started leaking 3 months ago, so it was in warranty. Well, you didn't tell me we're out of warranty. I can't go back to my roofer and get another year. Then you don't have the right to say, fix it for free, I don't have to do anything. What you can do then is say, but my roof still leaks, you built it incorrectly. And the contractor can say, prove it. If you prove it, I'll fix it. So then you can sue them and make a construction claim of a construction defect. So you always can claim both. Warranty claim means contractor has to come in and fix it, no questions asked. Construction claim says, if you prove that I screwed it up, I have to fix it. But the owner is not without remedy if they fail to do it within a year. It's just the remedy is a little bit more. It shifts the burden. The contractor under a warranty claim has to come in and say, well, no, the reason why it's not working is because your satellite provider, when they were up there and installed the satellite on your roof, drilled this big, huge hole in your roof. That's what's leaking. You ruined my roof. So it's not my fault, so I don't have to fix it for free. They can defeat a warranty claim by suing some other intervening cause. But in either instance, the owner has a warranty claim and then eventually a construction claim for that statute of limitations period. The 1 year period can be extended if the contractor comes in and performs work after substantial completion. In the period of time between substantial completion and the actual completion of the proportional work. What this says is, roof starts leaking at month 9. You call the contractor in to fix it at month 9. You can make the argument that at month 9, the 12 years starts again. The 12 months starts again. Because you didn't give me a clean and free and clear and clean roof for one 12-month period. That's what you guaranteed me. Now we fixed it. Now I get another 12 months. And when we get to that end of that 12 months, now your warranty's over. So that's something that you can try to do, that you can use this one-year period, the extension of time, because they've come in and fixed it. 12.2.4 talks about that they have to pay for that or damage. Just trying to see what else here is important for the exam. 12.2.5 talks about the statute of limitations here. And it talks about the one-year period of the statute of limitations. So that just says of how long the period of you can bring in a warranty claim. So it just reminds the owner that you have to abide by that. Article 13... Federal Arbitration Act. I'm seeing if there's anything here relevant for you guys. Rights and remedies. 13.3.2 is important for what the owner does. It says, no action or failure to act by the owner, architect, or contractor shall constitute a waiver or right or duty afforded them under the contract. So, if I have a right as the owner to have a building that's free and clear from defects, if I paid for it, that's not a waiver. If the contractor has a right to be paid for something, if I didn't invoice you in the month that I should have invoiced you and waited a month, that doesn't waive my right for that payment. So if you have a right underneath this, your failure to act doesn't necessarily remove or waive that right. Silence does not void provisions of the contract, is the best way to think about this. You still have the right under this contract for as long as a claim can be lasted. I didn't make a claim for a delay right away. Well, you can argue if you took too long, maybe you waived it because there was that 21-day provision. But if you don't have those things, there's different ways to say, I didn't waive my right for a delay claim there. Tests and inspections, we don't have to worry about that. Okay. Termination suspension. So, we have about 10 minutes, because I started late. I apologize, we're going to get you out of here. Last thing I want to do is do termination suspension, because these are two provisions, 14 and 15, are very important as far as what you want to do in termination. Okay? The contractor is allowed to terminate this contract for a number of things that are stated here. If the work is stopped for a period of 30 days for these four reasons, the court stopped it, the government came in and shut it down, the architect hasn't issued a certificate of payment within 30 days, or the owner has failed to give them reasonable evidence to pay me. Or the owner has failed to furnish contractor reasonable evidence under 2.2, that's the says I got enough money to pay. Remember way back when we talked about the contractor can say, hey, show me that you have the funding for the project. So if any of these, 1, 2, 3, and 4 happen, the contractor can say, I'm terminating this contract. As a side, just for you guys' knowledge, and you can tell your owners this, every time it says the contractor can terminate, I say the contractor can suspend. I don't want a contractor to have the right to just walk off my job for any reason whatsoever. In my opinion, the only time a contractor can terminate a contract, it's not what the AAA document says, but I change it, just so you know, is if I'm not getting paid. The contractor's not getting paid, they can walk off the job. Everything else, they can be compensated by what's in here about suspension and otherwise. But for the purposes of the exam and the purposes of this document, these are four reasons that if the project is suspended for 30 days for any of these four reasons, contractor can terminate and walk off the job. They can contract to terminate under 412 if, not the three reasons above, but if the project is suspended by an aggregate of 100 days, for 120 days in a 365-day period. So, it doesn't have to be the four reasons above, that's only if it's in 30 days, but if the project gets shut down because there's financing and we're all delayed for 100 days, the contractor can say, I'm done with this project. I got to move on with my business. I can't be walking around. I say suspend, but they say terminate. If 413 says, if for the reasons above, in 421, and 14.1.1 and 14.1.2, they have to give 7 days' notice. And that gives the owner the chance to fix things within 7 days. So they can't just walk off. They have to say, hey, by the way, you haven't paid me, or you haven't done this, you haven't done that, or we've been suspended. I'm giving you 7 days' notice to fix this. And if you fix it, or you commence fixing, if the owner fixes it, commence fixing within 7 days, contractor can't terminate. So it's again to have communication. 14.1.4, if the work is stopped for a period of 60 consecutive days through no fault of the contractor's subsequent hour, it's 60 consecutive as opposed to that 30 of above, the contractor again, on 7 days written notice, can terminate. So 14.1.1, 1.2, 1.3, and 1.4 are all reasons why the contractor can terminate the contract. 14.2 talks about why the owner can terminate the contract. And under 1 is if the contractor doesn't give enough materials or labor. If number 2, you don't pay your subs. If number 3, you violate the laws. Or number 4, you're guilty of a substantial breach. Remember that clause back in 8.1 that said time is of the essence? Every single one of those dates they must meet. And if you've substantially blown one of those dates, sub 4 says, I can terminate you, contractor, because you're late. That's why a contractor wants to say, I don't want every date, I just want important dates. But this says, any substantial breach, and the owner can terminate the contract. So this is the hatchet, this is the hammer. If any one of those 4 things happen for any reason, owner can terminate. And if they happen above, you have to have a certification by the initial decision maker. Ooh, that architect has to come in and agree with you now. Under Article 4.2, it's going to, 4. Whatever it is, 4.4.1, whatever, it's the architect that's going to come in and say, I agree with you, owner. One of these 4 things under 4.2.1, 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, one of these things have happened. And I, architect, or I, initial decision maker, under 4.2.2, certify that one of those 4 happens, and now owner can terminate. So there's a 2-step process for the owner. One of those 4 things has to happen, and then they have to tap the shoulder of the initial decision maker, whoever that is, architect or some party you hire, to agree with them and certify that. If the architect or the initial decision maker fails to certify this, and the owner terminates, that can be wrongful termination, even if one of those 4 things can happen. I had that very case, my very first federal trial. I was a contractor. The owner came in and terminated. It was based on one of those 4 items. They were correct. We were way late on the project, substantially delayed on the project. They didn't get the engineer, who was the initial decision maker, involved in that process. We went to trial in federal court for 3 weeks, and that was one of our biggest defenses, and we won. And so they didn't get a dime. They sued us for $8 million. We had a $2 million counterclaim, so with a $10 million swing, we didn't get a dime. I'm not allowed to tell you how much we got because that's just part of the settlement, but we ended up winning the case of what their ultimate dollars were because they didn't call the engineer and do this 14.2.2. So I raise this to you guys because you probably will be the initial decision maker. And if there's discussions with the problems between the owner and the contractor about how bad the projects are going to go, remember today's class where Hanahan told you, make sure the owner taps on your shoulder and says, are we allowed to do this? Because 14.2.2 says, I got to have my 30 cents in there. And that's why it's a big deal. Terminating contractors is not good. You don't want to do it. It costs everybody tons of money. Lawyers are involved, blah, blah, blah. So it's a 2-step process here. So I want you guys to remember that because we beat the other side because they didn't call their engineer. So. And then there's these subcontract, sub-provisions under that, but I just want you to know that chunk under 14.2.2. 14.2.4 just talks about how the payment comes. So instead of reading what's specifically in there, I'm going to give you, and this will not be in the test, but I'm just going to show you how the math works. I have a $10 million project. We're $6 million into the project, and I terminate you. If you had finished the project, I would have paid you $4 million more. Expectation damages of how much I would have had to pay. This provision is an expectation damage clause. What it says is if I end up spending $5 million, I thought I was going to spend $10 million, I paid you $6 million, I spent $11 million ultimately, you owe me $1 million. But if I thought I was going to pay you $10 million, what's different about this one here, I terminate you for cause. You screwed up no matter what. And I thought I was going to pay you $10 million, I paid you $6 million. If I get the project done for $3.5 million, I have to pay you that $500,000. because you expected to get the job done for $10 million. This gets you more money if the owner can finish it cheaper than you originally did. Never happens, because termination is a nightmare and you have to get people up and it's running to speed and everything else. But this allows that if you get it in cheaper than what the first contractor provided, you have to pay them that additional funds, because that's what you promised to pay them for the completion of the project. Doesn't make sense, doesn't seem fair, never happens because it's never going to be cheaper, but it's there in theory. But I've been doing this 35 years, I've never seen it happen. But it's there. So that's what you need to take from 14.2.4 is the money that's going to be how it happens. 14.3 is suspension for convenience. Here's what I'm going to, if there's going to be anything on the test, it won't be exactly like this, but it's going to be like, I just don't like you, so I'm terminating you. And I terminate you, and I have to give you a certain period of time. I have to give you notice to do that. And there's going to be an adjustment under the contract term. And under that adjustment, I didn't like you, I didn't like the color of your tie, I didn't like the way you show up to work, your car was too loud, I don't care what it is, or maybe I didn't have enough evidence to show that you're a complete screw-up and you breached the contract. Instead of going through the big lawsuit of trying to prove that you're in breach, I'm just going to tell you to go away. If I do that as the owner, anything that I haven't paid you that's outstanding, any squabbles that we're having, I have to pay you that. You're going to have costs because you're renting equipment, maybe you had a year lease on a crane, and you got 3 months left on that lease. I have to pay you that. So there's some wind-down costs that the contractor has to pay because they were terminated for convenience. They still have to pay, and they didn't do anything wrong, according to the owner. So the owner has to pick up those costs. Again, it's fair. It's more fair if I'm firing you because I don't like the color of your tie. But it doesn't seem fair to the owner, and this is where the discussion always happens, is I say to an owner, yeah, we have some breaches here. Here's what's going to happen, and here's how much it's going to cost for the lawsuit. We can terminate them. You've got to get a new contractor in. You're going to get up charges for that. You're going to have all these costs for this. It's already going to cost you more to finish the damn project. And then you're going to get a lawsuit from them because they're going to say they didn't really breach, and then you're going to have to pay me, and blah, blah, blah. And now your all-in costs are going to be huge because of me and all the other delays. And the contractor that's coming in won't be picking up subcontractors 1, 2, and 3 that you want to bring with them. They won't. So let's let them go, because it's cheaper to let them go and to pay those rental fees and whatever they have to do to get them off the site and keep me out of it, and you move on with your project. That's when you terminate for convenience, where it makes more business sense to just move on than to get caught up in the fight. Fights happen. I'm here for that. I will fight forever if you want me to. I'm happy to do that. But I will always advise an owner that it's expensive to fight, and that's just the nature of the game. So that's all you need to know from 4.3 on a high level. And 4.4, same thing. It was 4.3, 4.4, all that, for those you have to do that. And 4.43, all of those are just as a general on the termination fee. That's all you have to need to know for that. Claims and disputes. Crap. Are you guys okay for me to just do this last part? Okay, sorry. I apologize because I was late. A claim, capital C, is a demand or assertion by one of the parties seeking as matter of right money or time. So when you see the word claim as a capital, you jump to this section. And this defines whether I'm asking for money or time. Could the owner asking for money because I had to pay somebody else more money to fix your work? Could the contractor asking for money because the change order cost more money, whatever it is? That's a claim, and you jump to Article 15 for that. There's a time limit on claims. 15.1.2 says you need to commence it within the period by applicable law, but in any case, not more than 10 years after the date of substantial completion. So this creates its own statute of limitations. The AIA says at the outset, the longest a claim can be is 10 years after substantial completion. Now, if you remember, in Illinois, you have that statute of repose for 10 years, and then you get an additional 4 years if you discovered something at the end. So if you're advising people of contracts in Illinois, strike out the 10 years and stop it as specified by applicable law. Stop it there. Because applicable law will give you the 14 days, the owner, the 14 years on that period of time. If you're in Wisconsin and Minnesota, the applicable law is 6 years. Leave it in. Maybe you can stretch it out a little bit more. So different states have different statutes of limitations. California has a 13-year statute of limitations, statute of repose. Ours is 14. There's all different ones. So if you are in a state, like I said, especially Illinois, I put a period after the word law and strike out the rest of the sentence. But this is at least an attempt by the AIA to say, you can't sue me forever, which is fair. Notice the claim. It talks about how the notice, it has to be within 21 days, it has to be in writing, and so forth and so on. I will tell you this as a matter of course. This 21-day provision, lots of courts ignore that. They say, wait a minute, if the general contractor didn't get this proper claim in by 21 days, then who's going to get screwed here? The subcontractor that's owed that $100,000. That's not their fault. What if it came in 28 days? What if it came in 30 days? But people were talking about it, but they didn't fill out the formal notice. Judges will be wishy-washy with this. They don't have to be. I have had judges that enforced it straight to 21 days. But the perception is, if we go way back to what the purpose of the law is fair and equality to protect the public interest at large. And if this 21-day notice ends up with people that are justifiably and rightfully owed money on a project where they didn't get paid, the judges will kind of turn a blind eye to this. It's happened to me in cases. I've argued it all the time as it happens to the owner. They didn't give it in 21 days. They're like, yeah, well, but what did you know? And what did you talk about? And like, it just kind of goes away. But it's there for a reason. And it's there to make sure. And if you want, if you write a letter to them and say, hey, this came in after 21 days, and you documented and you were able to show, that may help you in court, and it may convince a judge. Not all judges are going to ignore it, but some will. And I, like I said, I had a big case. Like, it was a multi-million-dollar case where the judge ignored it. We ended up winning anyway on different defenses, but he ignored it because he's like, is this really fair? I mean, that's what he said to me. And I'm like, it's fair because they were contractually agreed to it. He's like, counsel, is this really fair? I'm like, Your Honor, it's in the contract. And he's like, let's move on. And I knew he was never going to give it to me. So so that's what you want to know about 15.1.3. Continuing contract performance, 15.1.4 basically says, just because there's a claim, you need to continue to do the rest of the work. So even when we have a dispute, it doesn't mean you get to stop on everything else. We'll figure this out, but let's keep working. That's what 15.1.4 says. 15.1.3, if you need to make for additional costs, you have to give the notice proceeding, so maybe you have to worry about that. Same with additional time. Weather conditions talks about weather. Claims for consequential damages. This is not going to be on the test, but this should be in every single one of your contracts. This is a waiver of consequential damages. I'll give you the best way to give an example of why you need a waiver of consequential damages. I had a lawsuit that had to do with the development of a casino down in New Orleans area. The amount of money that they made, this was 25 years ago, they made $1 million a day on the slot machines alone. Just the slot machines, not the rest of the tables and everything else. So there was a liquidated damage clause for when the project was late, that the contractor owed us like $250,000 a day. Even though it never would even come close, but because they couldn't get $1 million, the contractor would have gone bankrupt. Those dollars that have nothing to do with the building, of building the building, the money that's being made from the slot machines, the candy that's being sold off the rack, the toys that are being sold to the Kmart or wherever it is. Kmart doesn't exist anymore, but to a store. Those are consequential damages as opposed to direct damages. You want, in the world of construction, to have both sides waive consequential damages. Any damages you claim relate to the construction of the building, the delay that I had, the labor, the materials, and it's not your lost profits, it's not your one-armed bandit money, it's not the toys, it's not the candy, it's none of those things. Your business and your operations, you have to figure out how to figure that out. Maybe we solve it by liquidated damages or otherwise. But you want to waive consequential damages because the consequential damages coming out of businesses is astronomical. I mean, like I represent a lot of power utility companies. The hundreds of millions of dollars that they lose in selling electricity if the generators aren't online would put every contractor out of business. Those are consequential damages, so you don't pay and you waive those consequential damages. That's what 5-15-1-6 is. So you want to make sure every contract, and you as an architect should have a waiver of consequential damages in your contract with the owner. So if you're delayed on the drawings, the owner can't come back and say, hey, you owe me money for my people not selling candy or whatever it is. So that's all you need to do about 15-1-6. 15-2, somebody had a question about the initial decision question on the exam. It was a creative answer. I didn't agree with the answer, but I gave them the point because they made an argument and because I hadn't taught this. The initial decision maker is before mediation, and it specifically says they shall serve as the initial decision maker. Sorry about that. Went the wrong way. As otherwise intended, and shall be required as a condition preceding to mediation any claims. The argument on the exam was, hey, they could have been a mediator. That's like somebody that's balancing the neutral things about them. And I was like, technically you're wrong, but you haven't been taught this part of this agreement that says the initial decision is a condition precedent before. So this is a step negotiation. So all I'm going to do here is tell you three steps that takes the rest of this provision of 15. The first step is a claim comes in between, let's say it's owner and contractor. You call your initial decision maker, and they look at the facts, and they make their decision. It's not binding. The parties don't agree. It's a condition precedent to mediation. And then the parties can mediate, and that's that non-binding resolution. You can choose the initial decision maker to be the mediator. I wouldn't recommend it because they're involved in the project. Or you get a neutral mediator, somebody, a third party outside. If it doesn't solve by mediation and you've checked the box, you have arbitration. So it's a three-step process. The initial decision, mediation, arbitration. And if you look at the end of this provision, it has initial decision, it talks about it. And then it talks about the initial decision all under 15.2. And then 15.2.6 says you can file for mediation. And then we have 15.3 that talks about mediation, and we've already gone over mediation. And if we can't solve it by mediation, 15.4 is arbitration. So all you need to know for purposes of the exam, claim comes in, you have to have notice, initial decision maker, if it's not resolved, mediation, if it's not resolved, arbitration. And that's basically all it says. It talks about there's some rules about who you use and how much time and everything else. But for your purposes for the exam, and just for general of how this part of the process works, this is what you just need to know for the back end of Article 15. All right? Any questions? I know this is a ton to be jammed in. Go back and listen to this if you want again. Question over here. Oh, I didn't go into retainage very much here, so you want me to answer that. Okay. Here's what retainage is. On every project, oh, this is great, I apologize. I kept saying retainage, but I didn't cover it because it's actually in, retainage is talked about in Article 9. Here's what retainage does. I submit an invoice, an application for payment to you for $1 million. Architect says, yeah, that work was done, it's all done well. You owe the contractor $1 million. No, you don't. What you've negotiated at the very beginning of the contract is I'm going to withhold a certain percentage of every application for payment. In most states, it's either 5 or 10%. Some states, and some processes, it's 10% for the first half of the project, zero retainage for the back half of the project, so at the end there's 5% withheld. The purpose of retainage, so when I get that $1 million invoice, if it's a 10% negotiated, I only pay you $900,000. Or I pay you $950,000, it's a 5% retainage. The purpose of that retainage is the contractor has earned the money. They are owed the money. It is not the owner's money. It is the contractor's money. I am just holding it in escrow, effectively. I haven't turned it over to you. Because when we get to the end of the project and there's squabbles about substantial completion and there's these little things that aren't getting done and all the stuff that has to finish things up and the contractor's like, I'm out of money. If you paid them 100 cents of the dollar, you have no leverage against that contractor. But if you're holding on a $10 million project and you're holding $1 million, 10% retainage, or even $500,000, that's real money. And so you have that $10 million project and you're holding $500,000, the contractor is going to show up and get that punch list done fast because they want that $500,000. Now you have different formulas of once, and substantial completion is normally when that retainage is released. So normally, if it's on a basics, just AIA document, when you hit substantial completion, you get the whole $500,000. What I do is I say, at substantial completion, I'll give you half of the $500,000, and then 30 days later, I'll give you another half, and then eventually at final completion, I'll give you the remaining. So it's like half, quarter, quarter. So you can break it up, keep their feet to the fire. So retainage is a very, very important tool. It's consistent throughout all of construction. Some states have laws about how much it should be. Some states, like even Tennessee, you have to put it in a separate bank account. Nobody can touch it. Some places like Illinois, you can steal whatever you want. The owner just holds on to it. A lot of times you use Chicago Title and Trust. But that's what retainage is. It's just to protect the owner from the contractor. Or even like the contractor, like, because when you get to the end of the project, the contractor wants to take the A team and move it on to their next project. So they bring in the B team, and then they're like looking around and they're not doing the best stuff. And the owner wants that A team there till the end. So it's an incentive for both sides to get things done. That's what retainage is. Normally between 5 and 10%. Okay. Thank you for reminding me. That's it. We will talk next week.